Hello, you're listening to Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
Today's episode is our winter 2023 anime season reviews. We still got way too many to go through. I was looking to listen, like, Chris, we barely knocked out any of them last time, but we're kind of on a schedule, so it's fine. But hopefully we can get through the rest of this time. We'll see, though. But yeah, as per usual, at otakuspirit.com is where you can go for all of our information, links, and all that kind of stuff. Discord, Patreon, ways to support us, YouTube channel, all that kind of stuff. We thank everybody for their continued support, especially those that support us through monetarily, keeps things going, and hopefully eventually have Chris giving up all of his other jobs. We'll see, though. You mentioned that today. You want to hire me? Like, yeah, it would be nice to have somebody edit videos and stuff like that. It's just so strenuous, but it is what it is. Passion, it drives you. Calvin Klein. I don't know. It sounded like a Calvin Klein commercial.
Did it?
No, probably didn't. It's fine, but yes, let's just jump right into it. Let's kick things off with the one that we unfortunately couldn't do last time because Chris was still trying to finish it. You said you did finish it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Endo and Kobayashi Live, the latest on Tsundere Villainous Lislot. This one was streaming on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes, and pretty much opens up following two students, one Endo and one Kobayashi, as the title leads you to believe. It's obvious that Endo likes Kobayashi. He ended up actually joining this broadcasting club just to hang out with her, despite him kind of claiming that he's doing it because he wants to be a broadcaster, because he used to play, was it baseball or basketball? He used to play basketball and kind of shifted this direction. So from the other side, Kobayashi really, 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 really likes this one Otome game, mainly because she likes the villainous in the game itself, Lislot. She absolutely adores Lislot. But unfortunately, like typical villainous or Otome games, the villainous always ends up dead at some point. She did mention later on there is a route where she does survive, and that's the one where everybody falls in love with the main character. But yeah, she's played every route over and over and over and over again. At some point, she even ropes Endo into playing it with her, with the idea that he would be like a commentator. He would commentate over it, and she would be the expert sitting in the panel. And so they start playing the game itself. And then quickly they find out, as Kobayashi's like screaming about like how much she loves Lislot, the prince, the main love interest of the game itself, Sigwald, ends up hearing them. And then I was like, wait, this is a really cool game. It has like voice activation. She's like, no, it doesn't have that. Come to find out, there's just the game itself is for some reason responding to whatever they say as almost like the voice of God. It starts off with only Sigwald really hearing them. So whenever they say things, Sigwald can hear it. Kobayashi even tests it out by saying, Sigwald, Lislot actually really loves you. Go kiss her. And he actually does it. And she just freaks out because she gets what she wants. But it kind of turns this whole thing where they're playing the Otome game. They're trying to do anything they can to make sure that Lislot lives. At the same time, informing Sigwald through this quote-unquote voice of God, he thinks it's Endo-sama and Kobayashi-sama speaking to him. Through this voice of God, he's able to understand what Lislot actually is saying, because obviously the joke is that she's a tsundere, but it's actually now you find out that there's a reason why Lislot sucks at communicating what she actually feels. She's afraid of it. And that kind of sweeps into the grander story of why Lislot has to die is because she ends up becoming possessed by this witch. So it's their attempts to inform Sigwald what she's really saying, while at the same time trying to, progress the story and make sure that she is happy in the end. And yeah, at least Lislot gets the love that she loves so much, Sigwald. So yeah, it's basically live commentary, let's play with this other world of Otome game. So your thoughts?
First off, love this show. It absolutely fantastic. The artwork is great. The storyline is absolutely fantastic. One of the really cool things about the way this story played out was this undercurrent that Andrew kind of hit on with the Witch of Yore and how she plays into the whole storyline towards the end. I thought it was really fantastically done. Right up to Andrew is mentioning the idea of Lislot being afraid of expressing her feelings, and there's actual in the storyline, they actually explain that, and they did it surprisingly well. I think a lot of the things that she does as a tsundere actually make a lot of sense in the grander scheme of things, especially towards the end when a lot of these things really come into this forefront, forcing a lot of characters to face the reality of their feelings. And I thought it was all really well done. I give this story a lot of credit, and it's one of those, I wish there was more, but at the same time, no, I think it was a very, very complete story, and it doesn't need anything else.
Yeah, full adaptation, thankfully, for once. We have a full adaptation type of story, which is always great. No, I will say, like, with the basic concept that it opens up with, I will say that it feels a little bit repetitive, even though I really love Lisa Lott, so every time she freaks out, like, the one example that's really simple is when they're in the cafeteria area, and Lisa Lott is sitting there, and then Sigvald walks in and says, you know, they tell him, Sigvald, she's got a flower petal on her hair, so grab it. And so he goes over and he grabs it, and she goes, I know we're set to be wed, but don't touch me in public. And then they're like, oh, look at Lisa Latte's acting like she's upset about it. But actually, you know, she's actually deep down, she really likes the fact that you did that. And so he goes, okay, well, if you don't like me touching you in public, should we go somewhere private? And then she just blows up in air, and they're like, oh my gosh, now she's super flustered. That stuff is really, really cute. But I will admit that kind of the formula itself can feel a little repetitive from an outsider's perspective of a tsundere. The thing that I think kind of helps it is that over time they sort of change the formula a little bit by the mechanics themselves changing. Their quote-unquote god powers, their influence to the game itself keeps shifting. So it turns into these like divine blessings. So obviously the big question mark is, okay, if they're trying to get Lisa Latte with Sigvald and the main character is Fine, well, then what happens when Fine is no longer being pursued by Sigvald and walks out the building because she's not romantically connected to Sigvald? Well, they have to shift the narrative perspective to somebody else, otherwise they can't see what's happening between the two of them. And so they do that kind of stuff to mess with it. The thing that I thought was, to get my negative out of the way, it's not the best-looking show ever. It does have a flop here and there. It does enough to make it presentable. I kept joking about the fact that whenever it shows Kobayashi and Endo in the room and it shows its upper perspective shot, it's like their fingers on the controller. It looks weird. Like, have you ever seen a controller animator? There's little wonky moments of it. But I think my biggest real negative is that aspect of it kind of getting a little bit repetitive. But I think the biggest surprise most of all is that the grander story is really, like, interesting. Like, I didn't think that it would have that cool of a conclusion to it. I just assume another villainous Otome game, they'll help them overcome it with the power of love. Everybody's going to be happy. But no, what they end up doing with it in the end was really clever. I was very pleasantly surprised. I actually got emotional when a certain little doll shows up and somebody has a conversation. I got, like, swept up and I'm like, oh my gosh, they're doing it. It was so cool. It was fantastic. But I like the fact that it's a complete story. I think the only other real negative I would probably give it is there's a lot of side characters that just don't really have much to them. Especially later on when they're trying to get pretty much the entire Otome game harem together to talk about each one of them. Some of them are kind of just shrug characters that are kind of just felt like they're just thrown in there. But overall, I really loved Lisa Lott. I loved Kobayashi. Sigvald and Endo were fantastic. I love the goofy stuff they did with Fine because she's no longer a main character. She just kind of goes over and gets overpowered. Like, if you're not being pursued by Sigvald, I guess you just become OP and just raise up your stats like crazy. That stuff was kind of fun. But like I said, the overall story was a really huge pleasant surprise. When coming into it, I assumed when I reviewed this, it was going to be, here's a show where if you like tsunderes, watch it because Lisa Latte is super cute. But no, it ended up becoming so much more so. And yeah, the ED was, God, I love the ED. Like, I watched the ED every time. It fit the show so much. It was so simple, and it was such a fantastic ED. So yeah, I highly recommend it, especially if you like the Otome game type stuff. It's a nice twist to it because it's not just isekai into Otome game. It's like manipulating Otome game from the outside in. So yeah, cool stuff. Endo and Kobayashi Live, the latest in the tsundere villainous Lisa Lott. Good stuff. Our next one we have is The Magical Revolution of the Reincarnated Princess and the Genius Young Lady, which ran on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Daimedia. Did you finish this one?
Yes, I did.
You did. Did you? Well, no, hold on a second. I'm like, what do you think of it? But yeah, for those that are uninitiated for this series, which shame on you, essentially follows a princess of this kingdom, Anisphia. And Anisphia is kind of seen as kind of the stain of the royalty because, one, this world, it has magic in it. It's got a very political power-based system around magic. If you have magic, that means that you are blessed by the spirits, and there's like a lot of significance around the spirits blessing people with magic. But she of the royal blood, which is supposed to be the first to actually make pacts with spirits, doesn't have magic, so she's seen as a stain. So at some point, she decided that she was going to make magicology. You find out that she was inspired by this vision from her previous life to fly. And she loves magic. She's seen this one girl using magic, and she thought it was beautiful. She wants magic, despite the fact that she has no ability to do it. So she's started creating this magicology where she's essentially taking cores from monsters and grinding them up and making pills out of them and implementing them into items and stuff that she's seen in her vision, and all to make magic for herself. Plus, she wants to bestow it upon the world itself. She wants to give everybody this thing that she loves so much. So she's going out hunting monsters and coming back with blood all over herself and carrying pelts and stuff. And the king's like, what are you doing? You're supposed to be a princess. But yeah, that's her deal. Well, at some point we find out that because she did this, because she gave up the throne, now that falls upon her brother, who is the prince. And he's supposed to be wed to this Ophelia, which was the one that inspired Anisphia to the beauty of magic. Well, as they're going to this one party, he ends up declaring in front of everybody that Ophelia is trying to kill the one that he actually loved, which is Lainey. And so she basically is condemning Ophelia completely. But Anisphia at the time was trying out her new broom, crashes into the party, realizes what's happening, says, okay, I'll take her, picks up Ophelia and just runs off with her. Goes in front of her dad and says, I'm taking Ophelia with me. It kind of turns this whole thing where because Ophelia's entire reputation is destroyed now because the prince basically claimed that she was essentially trying to assassinate Lainey. Because her reputation is destroyed, Anisphia is going to have her be the spokesperson for her magicology. She's going to devise the magicology, give it to Ophelia, who's blessed by the spirits, to present to the people. And at the same time, you're finding out that Ophelia has nothing now. Like, she spent her whole life, you know, molding herself to become the next queen, and now she doesn't have that purpose anymore. So Anisphia is trying to kind of show her that there's other things in life that she can get into while at the same time creating magicology and getting more into the political systems and how important magic is and everything in the world and trying to possibly break that while others are trying to retain it. So that was a lot of explaining. What do you think? I'm going to catch my breath.
Andrew was watching this, and this was the one that every time he talked about it, he had this edge to the way he was excited, his excitement on this show that really, really had a lot of desire to go into watching this. The other one was, of course, Onimai, and Onimai was a given. I was going to watch that either way. But this one was one that I was really, really highly excited about watching. And sure enough, as I was watching this show, I got about two or three episodes in, and I was absolutely hooked. I loved this show. It was like, I know why Andrew loved this show. It just, it oozes. The storyline absolutely picks up from the get-go. You catch on to Anisphia. You absolutely have a drive to see what she's going to get into and what kind of absolute hijinks.
She's got an infectious character.
Yeah, she does.
The main key thing of the whole series is its characters. Like, it's characters, characters, characters.
And I absolutely was enthralled in it, especially when kind of the kind of big blow-up happens towards the latter half. I was absolutely just torn apart for a lot of these characters because I, in a lot of ways, I could see everybody's perspective in these different situations, and there was no good answer for any of this. And I absolutely loved how well they portrayed a lot of the frustration in a lot of those things. The very ending, I'm mixed on. I like it in one respect and in another respect, but the ending capstone, running down the the porch, we'll say. I thought it was absolutely beautiful. The porch. Yeah, I'm going to call it a porch.
Runway.
The runway. I didn't want to call it a runway because it's too implication of what it was that they were doing. But yeah, I loved it. I think it was a fantastic story. I thought it looked beautiful. I thought a lot of the characters were fantastically written. Yes, I loved it.
Yeah, I like I've mentioned, I think the main key thing in this series is characters. I early on kind of quoted this as being the Isekai liquor sequel because Chisato is so... Inisfia is so Chisato in that bubbly nature, but yet she has her own insecurities that she's hiding. I would say that with Inisfia, much more insecurities than you got with Chisato. But equally with Ophelia is the same concept as Chisato. Or not Chisato, Takina. Takina had that aspect of losing her home, and then she had to learn new purpose, learn new ways of life. And that's the same way with Ophelia, having that whole moment where she goes to see all the, you know, the attendants, and they have her wedding dresses sitting there, and she's like, this was what I was supposed to wear in literally a week. She had everything, was built to this moment, and then it was all shattered. And then she goes to Inisfia and is like, tell me what to do. Like, give me something. Order me to do something. I need a new mold to fit in because, obviously, I'm not going to be queen anymore. That's that whole, like, breakdown of losing everything you've built up to this current moment and then having it shattered in literally minutes. And I love that Inisfia, similar to Licorice Coil, doesn't say, Ophelia, do this. She says, just give it time. Let's go do this right now, and you'll find something. Find something new. Start over. Find a new purpose kind of thing. I'm not going to tell you what your purpose is. And I just loved their chemistry so much. And yes, this is a Yuri show. This is a Yuri show where they're not baiting it. This is straight up trying to build in this relationship, these characters and their bonds with each other, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And that extends with every single character they introduce. I love the king. He just wants the best for his daughter, and he acts like a dad. He just outbursts and wants to get her to do something properly. Ophelia's father was even fantastic. I love Tilty. I wish they did a little bit more with Tilty, but I still loved her character. Ilya was fantastic. The maid, getting into her and how Inisfia brought her in, just like Ophelia. And Lainey was a huge surprise for me. I made my assumptions on how they were going to play out Lainey, and it was not even close. And then there's this little moment where they have this big reveal, and it's like, oh my gosh, I love it. I love Lainey now. Like, she shot up on the waifu list, like, so freaking fast. I love what they did with each of these characters. Even the prince, as much as I was frustrated with him at first, I almost felt like he was a rip straight out of an Otome game, coming in with the whole, you were being mean to this girl, and I'm going to ruin your life over it kind of thing. But they end up doing some really cool stuff with him that I absolutely love. The overall story just accents the character so well, and it feels like it's so well crafted together that everything compounds to everything, compounds to everything, compounds to everything. And it leads to just some really great character moments. I will say, didn't like episode 11. It gets explained in episode 12, but I will admit that I didn't like episode 11. I got a lot of feedback with my video that I did of that one. And it came true in the idea that nobody's response to what is actually happening was true. It all led to something that was actually really cool because in episode 12, it, one, alleviates my issues with 11. Not all of my issues with 11, but alleviates most of it, but it also kind of, it full circles the whole story. And I really like how cleverly they did that. Visually, beautiful. I think the big key thing is I love the magic. How the magic looks, because they made it look so gorgeous in the contrast of the colors, the lots of reds and blues, and it kind of feeds into Nisfia's love of magic, because what did she do? She's seen Ophelia a long time ago using magic, and it was gorgeous. And I can see that beauty. And I love how they play it into a situation later on in this idea of, like, she gets awestruck by the beauty and it messes things up. It's super good in that regard. But it's visually very beautiful. Love the character designs. Love how it plays all that kind of stuff out. It's just it's a phenomenal show. The only complaint you can pull out of me, a true complaint, was that there was one or two conversations, one of them was in episode 11, where it just felt like the emotion was kind of going all over the place, and it felt like an unnatural conversation. But other than that, like everything else, I absolutely love the show. So I love that show.
You love this show.
I highly recommend it. It's going to go down as a contender along with Onimai for Anime of the Year easy. No doubt whatsoever. So Yeah, magical revolution of the reincarnated princess. I do like also the fact that it's an isekai, but doesn't rely on isekai, because technically the... I won't say it fully, because that would be spoilers, but she technically lives in the now. And I like whenever an isekai has a character that just lives in the now, and it doesn't really play into it at all.
Yeah, the only thing that she really gets out of her previous life is her ideas for her tools.
She wants to fly.
For her tools,
and
yeah.
She wants to fly.
And the fact that she wants
She's
to fly.
She's in a plane. I want to fly. Good stuff, though. Good stuff. Really love it. Moving on, Handyman Saito in Another World. This one was streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by C2C, based on a 4-comma manga. And this follows Saito, who is a handyman. A big shock, right? Spoiler. but no, he gets isekai'd into another world, a fantasy world with magic and adventurers and all this kind of stuff. And in his previous life in our world, he was a handyman, and he was never really... Not that he expected to be appreciated, but more in the negative, or the opposite, in the idea that he was very underappreciated. People, like, if he did help some lady get into her house and then he asked for pay, she would get mad about how much that he was charging her. He gets fired. He has replacements and jobs and stuff. Nobody really never really respected him at all. But now in this new world, he ends up joining an adventure party thinking, okay, I know how to pick locks, so I guess I'll become a quote-unquote thief, but he's technically still a handyman. And he's going with his party to unlock chests inside of dungeons. And now, suddenly, everybody appreciates him. Everybody's like, holy crap, you're so skilled. That's amazing. Thank you for helping with this. Oh, your armor's bent a little bit. Let me, ding it back out. So he dings it back out. He's really, really helpful in this other world. He's a jack-of-all-trades in a world where most people don't have these sorts of trades. And so he's extremely valuable, at least for the party that he's in. And so he has this feeling of appreciation suddenly. Now I'm wanted, and it makes him feel good. But of course, being in a magical world, you have all the dangers of being an adventurer in a fantasy world, and the kookiness of the world itself. Because yes, at its core, this is a comedy. And so it is just bonkers crazy with its comedy, getting into each of these characters and their different quirks. You have Morlock, who is extremely forgetful. He's old and senile, and he forgets like 2 seconds later that he was even in this party. So like you have this little moment where his other party members, Relza and Lafenpon, are walking ahead of him, and suddenly he stops and they turn around and he goes, hey, can I join your party? He's that kind of bad. He forgets all of his spells and stuff. Lafenpon is a fairy. She likes to charge everybody for her heals, and you find out why that is later. Relza is their warrior, that one up front, and she takes all the attacks. She has some insecurities about the scar on her face that she's trying to get rid of. And then a lot of other characters that get into there as well. So, did you...
Just the first episode.
I noticed because he kind of slouched back. And like, whenever he does a slouching back, it's like, oh, okay. Andrew's going to be talking for a while. absolutely love the show. Really, really did love the show. I was pleasantly surprised by it. I think the only real issue that I have, main issue, is just it's kind of back and forth with its pacing. Like early on, I was a little bit off put by the fact that the first episodes feels very skip-based. You would have like a 2-minute segment watching a character. They get to a punchline and it would cut to another area with some other character. You'd have a punchline, it would cut to another area. It was just all over the place. And so it felt very, very skip-based, very short-chaptered manga. And then at some point, when I started kind of getting used to it, suddenly it stopped doing that. And it got focused on this one labyrinth. Everybody arrived at this one labyrinth. And so everybody was together. And so it had a through line, a story that it was building up with this assassin that was trying to save this witch. And then pretty much after that, they went to another storyline that was more around Morlock. I'm mixed on this because I love the comedy. Like the first episodes were hilarious. It was so stupid funny. Especially like around Morlock and his memory loss and getting into a Lafenpon size unit. All that kind of stuff was hilarious. Ralza and her love for Saito, the elf monk and the priest that has to lick to heal her. Really funny stuff. I really love the comedy a lot. And then it got to that point where it stopped doing the skits and focused on the assassin. Didn't like it. When it suddenly got serious, it wasn't that the seriousness was a problem for me. It was more of a fact that the story it was telling was, it seemed very simple. I liked what they did with Morlock, because they kind of evolved Morlock's story a lot in that segment. But everything around the assassin and the witch and everything was like, it was very shrugged to me. And it was really heavy in its storytelling in that moment. So it kind of didn't work for me. But then, like, following that, they got into another quote-unquote serious moment, and I loved all that stuff because it was more focused around Saito, Rauza, more Locke, and Lafenpon. And that, so that whole segment worked really well. So it's really my only complaint is this middle section, which I felt was, like, very serious, but it was mostly a story that I didn't really care about. But other than that, like, the comedy is absolutely spot on. The relationships of the characters, spot on. And yes, Lafenpon, best now Toyama Fairy. And I loved her episode later on. Really loved her episode later on. I was like, yes, Lafenpon gets a moment. Lafenpon gets a moment to shine. Really adored the characters. Rauza and Saito's relationship is super good. And Morlock, him kind of adding to it was really, really good. And yeah, I just thought Lafenpon was just super cute. So it worked out really well. Really fantastic fantasy comedy. Doesn't really play too much on isekai jokes other than the fact that Saito has like modern type tools and stuff like that. It's mostly just fantasy spoofing and comedy around that stuff. So highly suggest if you're looking for something like that, and just expect that it gets serious and focused at some point, and you may or may not like it. So yeah, that's Handyman Saito in Another World. Definitely another one that's like up there is one of my favorites. So, oh, I know you watched Trigun Stampede, Chris. Oh, so what's your thoughts on Trigun Stampede? Yes, next is Trigun Stampede, ran for 12 episodes on Crunchyroll. It's already got a sequel announced for it. I'm not sure if they're going to do another season or if they're going to do a movie or something. But yeah, for those who don't know, this pretty much takes place on this one planet where this big set of ships ends up crashing on it. It's this big planet that's desolate and mankind's trying to survive. They use these things known as these plants that will essentially give them the resources they need in order to survive. Each plant can either produce objects, they produce water, food, or resources and stuff. And if they don't have a plant, they're pretty much dead because it's, like I said, it's a wasteland. This entire desert planet has nothing on it. So our focus goes in on Meryl, who is working alongside Roberto, and there are reporters that they're looking into stuff. And they eventually come across this very well-known wanted criminal known as Vash, and he's got a big bounty on him, and Meryl ends up kind of, instead of immediately arresting him and taking him, she wants to get information out of him, and they end up kind of getting wrapped up into Vash's past, which is heavily tied into pretty much everything that the humanity on this planet is dealing with currently, mostly in line with his brother, which is Million Knives. So, yeah, that's quite a step different than what most people expected from the original Trigun series anime anyways. A lot of people have criticized a lot of people's concerns about that because technically this is going a lot more, or at least it's getting a lot more into a lot of the manga that was skipped from the original anime adaptation. I came into this from a perspective of somebody who has not watched the original anime in a long time, so I don't remember much of it, besides Millie. Millie, that's not present currently. But I think the interesting thing is that my perspective, one, also it doesn't come with the manga either. I've never read the manga. So I came into this really kind of just seeing, okay, this is supposed to be an original. They claimed it was going to be original. It's still technically tying in with the story. So I'm going to not do like a lot of people are doing where they're saying it's either better or worse than one thing or another. And I will have to say, I give Orange a lot of appreciation for their animation with CGI because this is a full CGI show. I think they did a really good job of it. A lot of the animation is really fantastic. I think they're doing a lot better with facial expressions, which I think is always a difficulty thing in doing CGI animation for anime, is you lose a lot of expression. It looks very stiff. They're doing a lot of really incredible stuff with animation with CGI. That said, yes, I can. I think this is a series that, in the end, I like the overall story and how they presented it. But that was mostly towards a later part. Later part, they really do get deep into the history of the planet itself. And essentially, like, four different factions. You have, like, the neutral party, which is Vash. He wants everybody to be happy together. You have Million Knives that hates the fact that mankind is using these plants, which are technically life forms, by the way. I didn't mention that. These plants that humans are getting resources from are life forms that are tied in with Vash and Knives. And he wants to take the plants back from the humans, which will make them die. On the opposite end, you have the humans who want to use the plants to survive. So Vash is very much so cut in the middle. The fourth faction, by the way, being the I forget what they're called, the worms, I think they're called. It's like this the beings that live in this planet before the humans even arrived. That's the fourth faction. And so seeing how each of these sides technically have their pros and cons is really nice, because you can agree with Knives, and you can agree with the humans, and you can agree with Vash, and you can agree with the worms, who are just kind of standing on the sideline saying humans are terrible. That whole thing is fascinating, and I like the struggles that each one of them face. I think my biggest problem, besides Nicholas, I don't really feel... Besides Nicholas and Million Knives, I don't think they did very well with advancing any of these characters. Meryl, I didn't feel at all. Roberto, he just felt like a drunk, grumpy old man veteran of the reporting group. Vash kind of stayed the same for the most part. There was a little bit of a change in him in the later part of the season. But for the most part, I didn't really feel any of these characters really advancing. It really just felt like it was all kind of goofy antics to lead up to the final story, which does technically broaden everything that we're going to be getting into, hopefully, with the sequel. But in the end, I didn't really care much for any of the characters, and the comedy and the action scenes were good, but nothing really else here that I really took note of. But at the same time, it does have me kind of excited for what's to come. But I think the bigger issue that I have is that it was just kind of a there. It was a there type of show. It's there, you watch it, and there's nothing really too gripping about it. And the world itself, I think the world building is still solid, though. So, and I think that will kind of lead into the sequel and whether it'll be good or not. So, yeah, that's Trigun Stampede. It's kind of middle area for me. I wasn't bashing it for having it be a CGI or changing around things, but... obviously, most people are going to note that I just hate it because Millie wasn't in it.
That's
I got so many problems. Like, I made a joke at the end of one video saying, oh, maybe Millie could show up now. And somebody just blew up in the comments like, dude, it was just a joke. Calm down. You hate the entire show because Millie's not it. It's okay. It's all right. I just get comment dumped by somebody that's been building up anger for like 5 years. I don't know. Moving on, Campfire Cooking in Another World with My Absurd Skills. Streaming on Crunchyroll, running for 12 episodes, done by Studio MAPPA. And this follows Tsuyoshi, who is summoned to another world, a fantasy world, along with three others? Was it two? Three, because it was two girls and one guy. Three others he's summoned with. And of course, the kings, they're before the king, and they're talking about how they have all these great skills. This one's going to be a warrior, this one's going to be a healer, this one's going to be a mage. And then they get to Tsuyoshi. And his skill, his special unique ability is that he can access a shopping network, an online shopping network, which doesn't seem too useful for anybody. Even the other three heroes are kind of like, wow, that's a bad skill. And so he's like, all right, well, since you guys don't need me, I'm going to leave now. And the king's like, yeah, sure. Well, here, have this little bit of money and sure, you know, be on your way. And he really quickly gets the hell out of there because he realizes that if it's exploited right, his skill's like really OP, because essentially he can take any currency in this world, in the world that he's in, deposit it into this big web browser that comes out in front of him, and he can buy any nicety food product from our modern times Japan, and it basically appears in a box next to him. It's like a little Jeff in Another World, my Jeff Bezos joke that I made. A little Amazon box pops up next to him. So he gets the heck out of the country, one, because he's afraid that they'll discover how incredible his ability is and he could probably be just exploited. But additionally, he just feels like something's shady happening in the kingdom, because he said the king looked really rich despite the people being poor, which is nothing new. I'm not sure why you think that's shady. But you find out later as he's leaving, yeah, literally they're locking down the borders because there's a war going to happen. My assumption is the king was probably going to use the heroes to start a war. But he gets out of there. And he's quickly... Over some time, he has to travel through this dangerous area, so he hires a bunch of adventurers. They go adventuring together. He then discovers that whatever he's cooking from all of the stuff that he's buying is actually giving them stats up, which he kind of hides. And then at some point, a Fenrir shows up just out of nowhere with Eins on Gold voice. I love that voice. Shows up out of nowhere and tells him to cook him a bunch of food. So he cooks a bunch of food for this Fenrir. And then the Fenrir says, I'm going to be your familiar. And he's like, no, that's all right. I'm going to be your familiar, which is pretty much the Fenrir's excuse to make a pact with him. Thus, he has to feed him all the time, which, yes, becomes pretty much his personal chef. And it's kind of just their journeys together, as Fenrir is this OP wolf that just kills really powerful beings. He takes all the resources that he gets from the monsters to either cook food or to sell the parts to the Adventure Guild, which is always like incredible stuff that gets him lots of money. And he just doesn't have any, he doesn't even know what to do with his money. He's making so much money. But yeah, that's, and then they find Sui, which is super cute. Sui's great. Did you get the Sui? Did you finish it?
I didn't watch any of it.
You didn't watch any of it? That's a shocker. This was one of the ones I was like, I really kind of assumed that Chris will find some space in his time to watch this show because
I really did want to. Don't get me wrong. I really wanted to.
Overall, okay.
I probably still will.
It would be a solid one to go back to. I think the first thing I need to address is that Andrew doesn't like foodie shows. Never have. Cooking shows, the people characters sit around and they eat stuff and then the glitters happen. I watched Yakikatai Japan, was that what it's called? The bread making show a long time ago. I got my fill of the expressions of eating food way back there, long before the Food Wars show came out and everybody thought they made up that whole concept. I got tired of it way back a long time ago. So, yes, even with this show, I don't care for those segments. I really am tempted just to skip through it all. What was pleasantly surprising about the show is I really enjoyed Tsuyoshi as a character. He's smart. He's one of those isekai characters that they do exactly what you would do. Like, get out of Dodge. Like, get out of here. Don't show anybody what you're able to do. But yet still exploit it. Because you have this option to use it. You have this overpowered Fenrir. Use it. Gets you lots of pelts and stuff that you could sell for a lot of money. He's exploiting that whole system, not openly, but he's technically doing it. He's a really smart main character, and he's a likable character. Fenrir, Fedru, whatever you want to call him, he was fantastic. Again, Aiden's on gold voice. It was just super fantastic. Sui, like I said earlier, super cute. This little slime that gets overpowered at some point. They're really great characters that are kind of the most focused. Visually, it looks solid. I mean, MAPPA went really crazy with the meat cutting. Most of the other shots are kind of not over the top, but they still look good. The action scenes are solid. But overall, it's just an enjoyable experience seeing him going around the world and explaining things. I will admit, it gets repetitive after a while because it's typically Fedor goes out, kills something really powerful, comes back with pelts. He gives it to the Adventure Guild. The Adventure Guild freaks out because he's dumping out a bunch of legendary monsters and they have to cut it up and get all the resources. He gets a lot of money. He panics about the fact that he has too much money. And then they go out and they kill more stuff because they have to keep doing that in order to feed Fedor. And then it's mostly just kind of, okay, here's this next food that I want to try to cook. Let me buy those spices. I cook it. Fedru loves it because it's a different food that tastes even tastier. At some point, they get into the goddesses that are all kind of overlooking him and how he's having to send offerings to them and they're bestowing powers upon him. But for the most part, it's got a simple concept that was really enjoyable. Soft visual style to it that I really like. Very, I don't want to say neon colors to it, but very bright colors to it that's very pleasing. And like I said, just a really solid main character that's driving it all the way through. I won't say that it's the best show ever, but at the same time, it was at least an enjoyable cooking show and an isekai that was not kind of sticking to the usual stuff. It's kind of going for a different concept here and him, again, being overpowered because he's able to buy niceties and technically buff people. Fatter's getting like these massive stat boosts and stuff like that. It was fun. I enjoy it. So if anything that sounds interesting, definitely check it out. It was a solid watch, I think. Here's the show that Chris didn't watch, but he can talk about it maybe. My Life as Inukai-san's Dog. Straight on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes. Unfortunately, High Dive did have the censor version, but that's expected. I just never expected these companies ever to be able to lock in an uncensored version just because most of the cases they're locked into exclusivities in Japan and they don't want to do people doing importing or VPNing to watch it from us. But anyways, yeah, this one follows a guy who at some point wakes up in the body of a dog, and that dog is then picked up by the girl that he had a crush on in his school, which is Inukai. Inukai takes him back to her home, where we kind of find out that she has this other side to her. When she's at school, she's very cold, doesn't communicate to people. She's kind of keeps to herself, but she's very beautiful. Well, at home, when she has a dog now, which is him, she acts like she acts like a goofball. She acts like a psychopath. She acts like an absolute loony bin. like nibbling on his nose and giggling and kicking her feet around, dressing up in a dog outfit that's very skimpy and woofing at him and other things. Oh yeah, asking him to quote unquote come home as she's lifting up her skirt and chasing him around. She's crazy. But she really likes dogs, and he thinks he's super cute as his dog and as the dog. And then we meet her friend, which is Nekotani, and she has an absolute fear of dogs, which I sort of theorize. It's not that she fears dogs. I think she just fears being around anything that Inukai is obsessed with because Inukai is scary. And then eventually Tsukishiro, who apparently is madly in love with his past self before he became a dog, and she's she Kogias is a desk because she likes him so much. Yeah, so did the manga go further than the anime, or do you know? It got to the point where they revealed, he finally confronted, soft spoilers here, just in case people care, he confronts the person that technically changed him into a dog, and that was pretty much it.
That's pretty much where I got in the manga. So if the manga...
Did the manga stop, you know?
I don't know. That's as far as I got.
So what's your thoughts on the manga, I guess? We'll get a manga review and an anime review, I guess.
I thought it was goofy and fun. It absolutely works for me as just this etchy kind of whatever this particular story, the kind of thing is him being a dog and kind of goofy situations that they get into involved in that. I thought that the anime per se, what I did watch of it, and yes, I will be finishing this show because I just absolutely love this property. I think it's an absolutely fantastic story. It does what it's supposed to. It on the package, it says it's etchy, goofy fun. Guess what you get out of it? Etchy, goofy fun. That's all it is. And I think it does that in spades.
Yeah. I think that's the difficulty that comes in is that obviously what it's doing is going for etchy with the direction of the fetish of that, the fact that he's a dog and he's able to see things that would normally not be something those girls would actually show some random person, but in front of a dog, they don't care. And so it comes to that realm. And the thing that, of course, this one's doing, unlike most, is the idea that it's trying to be as absurd about it as possible and kind of one-upping itself every time it does something different. So starting off, it's her giggling in a bathtub while nibbling at his nose and woofing. Then the next moment, it's her dressing up in an outfit. And then the next moment, it's, again, her chasing him around, lifting up her skirt, saying, come home. It's trying to one-up itself every single time. And then getting to the point where he's got to pretty much disclothe and reclothe a girl while she's laying unconscious on the ground, which is absolutely incredible as a dog with just your mouth. But he pulls it off somehow. It's absurd in that regard. But at the same time, it's almost in the realm of, like, this is kind of scary. like I said before, Inukai's crazy and she's scary crazy. And it's like one of those moments. So like at some point, dude, are you going to be turned off by how crazy she is? You're seeing a very unsettling side of her, a side that if anybody were to think of wanting to go out with somebody would love to know before they go out with them. Because I guess unless you're really into that kind of crazy girl, you're probably going to be off by so many people going to comment right now saying, oh man, I've been to that. There are people out there that are into it, so I understand that. But me, it's like a big nope. Like, this chick crazy, get away from her quick. Nekotani, cute. Yeah, go for that. But no, Inukai, no. I can't back you up on that one. But yeah, it's absurd. At the same time, it's not really doing anything story-wise other than just, again, seeing another side of somebody that he absolutely loves and that not really changing his devotion to her and his desire to figure out how to get turned back, because even though he's kind of okay with the idea of being around her and close to her, he doesn't really want to see this stuff, and he really wants to get back and see if he can somehow pursue her as a human. So yeah, it's if you want to see crazy girls and lots of shots and perspective shots and stuff, check it out. But other than that, it's not really much there. It had a few funny moments, especially with the absurdity of it, but not like a laugh out loud comedy all the time. So I think that's the only negative that I can really give it. It being an etchy comedy, you would expect that it has lots of comedy, and most of it just really didn't work. So that's My Life as Inukai-san's Dog. You know what you're getting. It's on the package. It's all in the package. To Your Eternity, second season. Wow, this actually ended a long time ago. This is kind of like Eminence and Shadow. Was like a while back there, so we're finally talking about it. I don't want to get too much into details of the story of the series because I would like people to not know spoilers what's happening in the second season. But for those who don't know, it essentially opens up the original first season as this guy known as the Beholder later on placing this object upon this world. This object, whenever it's impressed upon by some other object, it's able to change its form into it. Like early on, this wolf collapses on top of it, and then he turns into the wolf, meets this boy, goes on a journey, and it kind of turns this whole thing where he's traveling around the world, learning about the world, because he starts off as a blank canvas, and so he has to learn everything. He has to learn language, he has to learn emotions and everything, and it's his journey throughout the world, meeting different humans, learning about their struggles and their relationships, and then learning pain and love and all this kind of stuff from the humans and interacting with them, and eventually learning languages and, yes, technically, eventually becoming jaded by the aspect of the fact that he's immortal, seemingly, and he's around a bunch of mortals. And so these people die through either death or decay, illness, accidents, or these beings known as knockers who are trying to stop Fushi. These knockers, if they penetrate him like some way, like stabbing him or something like that, they will remove one of his memories of these people that he has been impressioned upon. And once he loses those memories, he's unable to turn into the form of those objects or people. And those things are killing a lot of humans. And he gets to a point where he just wants to get away from humans so that they're not killed by these knockers. And so it opens up the second season where he is secluded. And eventually he's told, hey, the knockers don't seem to care about you anymore. They're killing the people now. So now he has to go back and help, you know, protect the people. They introduce another faction that worships Fushi that start to follow him, known as the Guardians. Eventually, he meets Tasty Peaches, which is, like, the best person ever. Bon Tasty Peach, which I absolutely love. But Tasty Peach, he is a prince, and he becomes, like, a critical change in Fushi's character in the second season as Fushi's being very distanced from anybody. Tasty Peach is just kind of that character that just... you're not going to say no and walk away. He's going to follow you kind of person. He's just that type that no matter how much Fushi pushes back, Peach is like, no, we're doing this. He's very infectious and you can't really ignore him kind of person. But additionally, Tasty Peach also introduces a very significant, I would say, mechanic that honestly for me, and technically Fushi's character, changes everything. I will admit that this show has sort of a, or at least it, from the first season, and especially as you get in the second season, it has a fatigue about it. Let's be honest. Again, this is a guy that lives for forever. He's immortal. And thus, everybody's going to eventually die, whether they die by accident or just old age. And it almost gives you this feeling going in the second season, like, I don't really care that you introduce a new character because they're just going to die. I won't say exactly how he fixes it. It's not like Tasty Peach is able to revive people or anything like that. But he creates a mechanic that makes everything significant. Suddenly, March from second character that Fushi runs into is March. Suddenly, that encounter has meaning. Everything in the story up to that point suddenly has meaning. And it changed my entire perspective of the show itself. And I love it for that. And it has me extremely excited for the third season, which they've already announced. I'm incredibly excited to get in the third season. But I think the biggest issue, there's two big issues the series has. One, I would even admit with the first season, Brain Space, when they did the first season, within like a quarter of the series, they just kind of, it felt like the production values went down. Second season, Drive took over. They kind of kept it consistently not great. So it's not a visually amazing show. They do a lot of really great perspective shots. A lot of the emotion in the characters is still expressed. But like a lot of the combat that... yes, there's a significant amount of combat in the second season. Just isn't that great. But it still... it moves. It kept together. We didn't get like shots of outside of buildings while people are talking or anything like that. Like, wake up, girls. It did enough to kind of keep it going. The other big issue... this series has it in the second season, had it in the first season. This writer has some big lulling points in this series that I feel like it just feels like nothing's happening. it almost feels like you get to a point where you're kind of going, I want to feel like dropping this. Like, nothing really impactful or exciting happens. The first season had it during the whole prison arc, or prison island arc. I hated it. I hated it in the manga. I hated it in the anime. It never fixed it when they went in the anime format. Second season has a similar kind of lulling point, like a 5 to 7 episode point where, yes, things are happening, but it's not like exciting, engaging type of stuff happening. It's a lot of buildup for what's to come. But that is all to say that it eventually gets to him. The first season, when they had that lull in the prison arc, I didn't have a payoff. And that was a very unfortunate thing. This one, at least, it built up to something and I had a payoff. So keep that in mind. This series does have lulling points. I joke about the fact that it's one of those series where it quote unquote gets good after such and such episodes. It sucks to say that, but I think the payoff is worth it. In the end, I'm extremely excited for season 3, and I cannot wait for it. So, yeah, if you guys want my spoiler thoughts, I made like several impressions videos on this series on the YouTube channel, so you can hear me gush there. But yeah, Tasty Peach is amazing. It's so funny because Tasty Peach is that type of character, especially in anime, that just doesn't work. He's like overly flamboyant, ooh, kind of type, you know. Usually it's like over the top and it's kind of annoying. No, Tasty Peach was so good. Like, he's got so much heart. He's a type of prince where, like, something happens, like an explosion and a bunch of people are in danger, and then the dust settles. What does he do first? He yells out for every single one of his men by name. Every single one of them. He loves all of his men, despite the fact that they'll, you know, become a chair for him or something. You think it's kind of disrespectful in that regard. He's got so much heart. I love him. He's such a good character. Kohaku, I struggle with a lot, especially towards the end. He's the remnants of something I really hated in the first season. So that never fixed in the second season. But yeah, it's some really great characters in the second season. So cannot wait for more of it. But there you go. That's my thoughts on To Your Eternity second season. Definitely a mixed bag. And for those who don't know, it's the writer that did Silent Voice. And I think because of Silent Voice, I think this is not to be... I'll not say that. It's going to spoil things. The writer knows heart, I guess, in the end. Oh, yeah, Echo. I forgot about talking about Echo. Echo's super sweet. I love Echo. By the Grace of God, Season 2, did you watch that?
Yes.
God, I watched that. You love the first season. By the Grace of God, second season, streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes. Of course, the second season of By the Grace of the Gods, which opens up with this guy that's an office worker who gets worked to death, and then he gets transported to another world, and the gods themselves kind of give him a nice new life. Like, they're like, man, you had it really rough last time. We're going to make a really great life for you. What all you want? We're going to give you a nice little location, and you can hang out there and stuff. And they just want to make sure that he has a pleasant life. In this new world, he's secluded for the first moment. Like, he becomes a tamer and tames these slimes and does really crazy stuff with the slimes. Even though they're, like, the weakest in the world, he just, like, finds them really soothing and... He does really clever things with them to create different species of slimes that all are able to do different things. Eventually, he ends up getting confronted by a group of tamers, which is all the family of... I don't know what the family's name is, but there's one girl named Eliara, whatever her name is. She's a tamer, too. And he sort of gets introduced into the village nearby, where he opens up a slime laundry service, because if you put your dirty clothes inside this one slime, it's able to kind of sud it up and clean it. And
it eats the dirt.
No, first he has the slimes clean up the sewage system of the place because it was getting overpacked. And after he did that, he opened up a shop to clean clothes. And so he opens the shop, and then going in the second season, he opens up another shop in another town. And then he gets resources and like creates an odor absorbing bag that he gives to like 50 people.
Charcoal.
And then
he's got a charcoal slime.
Eventually, we get to see the other girl that he met in the first season. She's at some school for training, and she has an episode. And then, that was pretty much... Oh, yeah, that was like the music box kind of indicating a little bit. There might be another isekai there.
We got a festival.
Yeah, the festival. Yeah, they did the festival. That was... Yeah. So, your thoughts?
I'm going to go ahead and keep this short because what me and Andrew pretty much joked about, that's pretty much all that happened in the second season. It does what it did in the first season. It just expanded like Andrew had talked about. I mean, he opened up a second shop in another town. They go into a little bit about where he came from, where he was
dropped off by the gods was apparently a kind of more dangerous part of the world. And so he's got to get his adventurer level up so that he can go there and all that stuff. So not a lot has happened outside of pretty much what we just talked about. It's a more lower paced type show. It just does what it does. And it just goes into more his building up of stress from, opening the second shop and wanting to help everybody. He has to at some point learn how to not,
rely on the people around you.
Yeah, to rely on people around him and not necessarily put himself wholeheartedly into everything he does. So yeah, it does really well at that. It just is more of a chill paced type show.
I admit that I was okay with the first season. I want to say that I enjoyed it. It wasn't like incredible, but it was a fine show. But I have to say, like, the second season felt like an I don't want to say, this sounds really harsh. It felt like I wasted my time watching the second season because I felt like nothing really good happened. Like nothing pinnacle, nothing really interesting, nothing of substance really happened for an entire season. Like I joked about before, he makes something that absorbs odors. So it almost felt like it spent three episodes of him going around running into people that just suddenly had issues with odors. And he's like, oh, well, here's a bag. Try it out. Oh, you have something stinky too? Well, try this bag out. There's those kids that are trying to do a lot of work to get money for themselves, and they're carting something that stinks. And he's like, oh, well, try this out. And then he runs into the guy that he met in the previous episode, that Piolo in the other town. And he's like, oh, he's got this big old bunch of barrels full of, it was like fish or something like that. And he's like, here you go. Here, use this bag. It'll absorb the odors. And then it just like keeps doing that. And it's like, can we do something besides handing out these stupid odor bags? And it kind of does that with a lot of other things too. And it's like, it's like the writer finds something and goes, oh yeah, he can create this. And then, okay, let's apply that to everybody. And then, yeah, the whole idea of opening the shop and relying on other people was about the only significant thing in it. Getting into the magic infused cart racings that apparently happen in the world, and this big trade area with all these mechanisms that are powered by the magic. It just didn't really feel like I got anything of substance in this season, and that's the difficulty that I really have. I kept watching it expecting, okay, what's this season going to do? I didn't really feel like any individual thing was like this pinnacle point of the story, other than just eventually leading to him having a festival.
Yeah.
And then it ends. It's like,
did a festival.
Okay.
That was the most significant thing.
That's literally it.
Like, oh, opening up the second store was probably it.
Yeah, and devising a self-defense method for whenever somebody's angry. You have an angry customer, so they have like this whole system where they lift up these glass shields, and this guy comes out with this weapon, and it's like, what? Literally just build a mock building out in the middle of nowhere? Like, there's like this big open field, blank open field, and he builds this mock building so that he can try out if somebody came in. So they built the shields, they chucked tomatoes. It's like, okay, next episode. Yeah, it's like I said, I felt very disappointed in the season. Didn't really feel like I got anything out of it whatsoever. So, but it's not a terrible show. So I wanted to actually see more of the school. Like, I actually enjoyed that episode because they were actually devising like a team build ups, and they had like the one girl that was, what was she, like a, she was a accessory or something like that, creator or something like that. And
yeah,
she, yeah, it was cute. I liked it. So that's Grace of the Gods. There you go. Season two, actually, not just Grace of the Gods. The Fruit of Evolution, Before I Knew It, My Life Had It Made, season two. Cheat skill in another world and made myself overpowered in this world too, creator Miku. So how is Chubby Guy Turned Into Hot Dude series doing? The first one that they created.
I have no
clue about the story. I think it was like he and his classmates got isekai'd. He got separated from them, and then he ate this random fruit that made him like evolve, quote unquote, and he became super hot, and then he fed that fruit to an ape that was in love with him.
Ape had already eaten turned into human. I remember.
Oh, sorry.
Spoiler. I'm gonna be honest. The second season I did not like as much as the first season.
So you're having a situation like Grace of the Gods.
It's funny because I liked the first season for its just goofy absurdity that they were just doing whatever they felt like doing in it, and it just that worked for me. In this season, it felt like they were trying really, really hard to... I don't know how to put it. It felt like they were trying to move their jokes in a certain direction that I didn't much care for. And so I was... a lot of the flavor just... I was losing. How do I put this? Because in the first season, their absurdity was all over the place. They whatever just felt like they were going to do, they just went ahead and did that. In the second season, they were trying to move everything into a direction so that they could tell the story that they wanted to. But they were trying to curtail the jokes around that in a lot of ways. So it became kind of this battler type thing. And it did not work for me in any way, shape, or form. And I got an insane amount of these stupid, goofy, derpy faces that for the first time, you guys will actually hear me say I don't like. It wasn't the derpy face. It's the that – you know what I – where they do the serious kind of it's not the derpy face, but it kind of
like
looks
the one
like
from the one where the guy, the mangaka, goes and lives in like some remote town. What was it called? Barakamon? That face where it's like super scrunched up and serious.
Yeah, it is. It did a whole bunch of those, and I could not stand it, and it was driving me nuts. But yeah, other than that, basically that not a lot of the jokes were working for me. I did have fun in general with the larger storyline coming together and being brought to the forefront, to an ultimate goal of, actually putting a Shinichi in front of a issue that he's going to have to deal with soon. So hopefully that will carry the rest of it. If they ever bring in another season.
Oh God, please no.
But as it stands right now, the jokes are losing a lot of their flavor. I like a lot more of the harem-esque aspect of the first season. This season being more of a battler type thing that they were bringing into the forefront is not working for me. So who knows? Maybe we'll figure something out in season three if they make another one.
Stop saying that. You're going to cause it to happen. Stop trying to make it realize. That's for Revolution season two. Whatever. Tsurune, let's talk about a good show. Tsurune, The Linking Shot, which is the second season of Tsurune, ran on High Dive. I forget how many. I think it was 13 episodes. Done by Kyoto Animation, obviously. This show is pretty much, for those who don't know, it's essentially this Minato kid who ends up joining this, or joining the club for, God, what's the name of the... It's not archery, it's a specific type of archery. This archery club. And as he joins it, he eventually meets up with this guy named Seiya. You get a lot into his backstory of Minato himself. And then going into the second season, we see our cast returning as they go into doing a lot of the local tournaments and stuff like that for the national tournaments. And their biggest kind of, most of the story, or at least growth in the characters overall, with the club at least, is them trying to learn sort of a... There's a term for it, but it's like their mojo, like how they're all going to link up with each other, quote unquote, linking shot, how they can synchronize with each other and get a flow going, which it eventually does lead into something kind of interesting in the later parts and how they kind of figure out how to create that flow between each other. Because typically with this particular type of archery, it's these five kids go up to the starting point. And then they take turns. The first person shoots at the target. The next person shoots at their target. Next person. And it goes all the way to the end. And then it starts back from the beginning part. And then whoever gets the most shots compared to them versus the other team wins. And so they're trying to create that rhythm between each other. And like I said, it technically does have... For the most part, for the most of the season, I'm like, what are you guys even talking about? Just shoot. I wasn't really getting what they were going with. But they kind of lead it into this idea of sort of the anchor... calming their nerves, like forcing them to stop and to kind of breathe. And I thought that was kind of cool. But it kind of turns into this whole thing where they get a rivalry with this other group. Their team is led by somebody that sort of hates Minato because he actually was able to go under the tutelage of somebody that his uncle was not able to. It's been a while since I watched this show. I'm sorry. It's been a while since the season ended. I think it was his uncle. His uncle was denied to go under tutelage of this lady, but she ended up training Minato. So he obviously hates him. But particularly with his school, they don't even have a coach. That's how they don't even have a coach. They don't have an archery field or anything. They just set up their own stuff against this wall and shoot. So they're kind of going from they're really scrounging for materials and equipment, but yet they're not letting that keep them down, which I thought was pretty cool as well. We got a little bit into the girls finally. We had the girls on the sideline the whole time, I think, for the most of the first season. Suddenly, they're making their own group, and they're going to competitions and stuff, which I thought was fantastic as well. But yeah, my thoughts on the second season. This is pretty much my same. This is a Kyoto Animation thing I'm feeling now. If this ever happens again, I'm going to be really crushed. With Sound Euphonium from Kyoto Animation, I didn't care for the first season. Going into the second season, loved it. Same thing with Tsurunene. I didn't really care much for the first season. I really didn't like Minato's story. It was very melodrama, but I stuck with it and I finished it. Second season of Tsurunene, loved it to death. Absolutely loved it. Loved the character growth, a lot of the struggles. They have the friendships between Nanoa and Kaito, their backstory and their relationship. They had a little bit of fallout. I thought was fantastic. Like I said, with Minato and Seiya and this other club group from this other school was fantastic. Really digging into Shu again, which was great as well. Getting in his kind of driving force and his kind of random encounter with Ryohei was really, really cool. I love the character interactions and I love their experiences together. And my gosh, the presentation. Let's just get into that. Kyoto Animation is obviously an incredible studio. One of the best, if not the best, for a lot of people, including myself. I can honestly say pretty much up there, possibly the best. I'd have to look at it again, but I think it's pretty much the best. It's rare for them to ever release anything that I don't love. But more so, it's rare for them to release anything that doesn't look absolutely gorgeous. And this show, I won't even say just visually gorgeous. I will have to say the sound. The sound is so freaking good. This is one of those shows where if I was ever blind, like if I suddenly was blind, I would want to just watch, or not watch. It's still technically watch. I would want to listen to an episode of the show because you can just feel everything in the sound. Like I said earlier, there's this aspect of Minato as an anchor trying to create a pause. Give them a moment to breathe. And he's stopping. And what he's doing in the course of the competition is he's holding his draw. He's draw the bow back and he's holding it. And you can hear the tension in the string. It's just like this tension. It's almost unsettling, but it's beautiful at the same time because I feel it. It's like I can feel the string in my gut. And it's just so beautiful. And they let it go. And you get that sound, the serenade, as they call it. That sound of the arrow whooshing back and it hits the target. And then the people yell out, Yosh, or if it hits, they usually yell, Yosh. It's so good. Like, the sound alone is absolutely breathtaking. Whoever did the sound design, I needed to look them up because absolutely incredible. But yes, visually, obviously, gorgeous as well. A lot of these, like, just the characters holding the draw and you just have these shots that go from, like, the ground up past their shoulder or whatever. It's just visually absolutely stunning and gorgeous. And it all portrays a competition in a way that's full of tension. Your gut's hurting. You're wanting to know who's going to win. You get swept up in the competition itself. It's so beautifully crafted. It's just easily one of Kyoto Animation's just, not just gorgeous for the sake of being gorgeous, but gorgeous while telling a story. It kind of reminds me back with Shogun Roku, Raku Shinju, when we watched that show. Well, yeah, Showa Studio Dean wasn't to the levels of Kyoto Animation, but they did a lot of incredible stuff with that show. And just telling a story through perspective shots, just minor details in the character's motion, their movement, that all tell a story in itself. Easily one of the most gorgeous shows that Kyoto Animation has ever done, and it left me speechless in a lot of cases. But yeah, like I said, even with that, you had, I think, like three or four different really kind of deep character story impact moments. Actually, probably more like six or seven. But each of the story arcs themselves were really well played out. I love the conclusion to most of them. The growth in the characters, finding their linking style, which, like I said, at first I kind of poo-pooed, but I ended up actually getting into something really interesting. All was really well done. Highly recommend it if you're a fan of Kyoto Animation or just sports club shows, whatever it is, definitely check it out. So, yeah, Tsurune, Linking Shot. The reincarnation of the strongest exorcist in another world. Did you watch this one?
Nope.
No? That's all right. I thought about it for a minute. That's all right. Yeah, this one's on Crunchyroll for 13 episodes. It essentially follows this very powerful exorcist that ends up getting betrayed because he was so powerful. He's like, he was this great powerful exorcist that took down these massive evil spirits, and eventually it sort of implies that because he was so powerful and well known in the world itself, the humans eventually betrayed him, using his own students against him, and got him killed. But while he's dying, he ends up creating this like reincarnation spell that reincarnates him into the body of a boy named Seika in a world with magic, a fantasy world. Now, obviously, being reincarnated in this world, he quickly finds out that he has zero ability for magic. That's okay, because he's the strongest exorcist, and so he ends up using spirit powers instead. But the kind of cool thing is that while his family, which is of this noble family that he's brought in, he was actually brought there by some random person, was raised by this noble family, they quickly find out that he has no talent for magic. But then he kind of sort of hides the fact that he has no talent for magic by sort of creating magic through his spirit powers. So, like, if he needs to create a fireball, he doesn't cast a fireball spell. He uses spirit power to create an effect that looks like fireball. And so that's what he kind of utilizes to eventually impress and get his way of getting into the academy. When he gets to the academy, he ends up finding out that the quote-unquote hero is in this academy. And so at that point, he decides, because he didn't like how things ended last time, he's going to not become powerful and save the world or whatever. He wants to, you know, not have any attention on himself. Instead, he's going to support the hero of the world. That way, that hero gets all the attention, but he's on the sideline supporting them and keeping in the shadow, essentially. And I love how they always do that, and they always end up doing something incredibly crazy and getting a lot of attention anyways. They did it pretty well in this one. He keeps to the shadows pretty well. But yeah, he's essentially supporting Amu, who is supposed to be the hero. The demons are already coming after her. They have, like, several attacks from demons coming to this area to try to kill Amu, and Seika's on the sideline just killing them before they even arrive to her. So that's kind of the gist of it. At some point, you have, like, Effa, who is the maid of the household that he was raised in. He kind of, you know, has his father let her go to the academy with him, and she's pretty devoted to Seika. While at the same time, he never really realizes it. He also has the spirits and stuff from his previous life, so he'll draw them out on a regular basis and kind of have to remind them that, you know, he's in control, and he's a little bit weaker in this world, so some of them can get a little bit out of control, and he has to kind of keep them in check. So he's got to kind of regain his power so that he can still maintain the control of the more stronger spirits that he has control over. So, yeah, and that all leads to some, I guess, big twist at the end of it. I just kind of shrugged at it, but it's kind of an interesting thing if you dig that or not. It could go into something interesting if they do a second season or the source material itself. So, yeah. This is kind of one of those isekais where it's an OP main character isekai into another world, but at least it has sort of an interesting twist to it. I typically don't really care much, especially for the reincarnated shows. I like isekai shows where it's like normal person isekai into another world, fish out of water. Yeah, they get OP most of the time, but typically with the quote-unquote reincarnates where it's a person from a world that has magic and some sort of ability transferred into another world with magic or some other ability, I typically don't like. But at least with this one, it's sort of a twist in the idea that he's not necessarily overpowered in the world. He's borrowing his skills from the previous world and sort of mimicking it. So they have this whole situation where they have to go through this trial to get into the academy. And again, they lay out a bunch of targets, and each one of them are highly resistant to each of the spells. So here's a target for trying out fire, so they have to use fire spell on it, and then how well they do depends on if they can join the academy or not. And he essentially goes to, like, each one of these, and he does some sort of spirit ability to mimic it. So if there's an earth target, he sort of just summons a bunch of material, and it's kind of interesting in that regard. So that's kind of cool because it's him introducing a concept that's not normal in the world. So when he fights a bunch of demons and he's doing some crazy stuff, like they stab him and suddenly he turns into a paper, they don't know what the hell's going on because he's so abnormal to the world itself, and his skills are very unique. And I like how each of his abilities are very clever. So, like I said, the paper replacement, the summoning a thing that can read person's mind and then lets it consume him. All that stuff is really fascinating how it plays out. I did really appreciate the demon that is able to read the mind, because not only does it use the demon to read the guy's mind to find out information about who is going after the hero, he has to pay the demon for doing it, so he allows the demon to kill the guy and consume him. And then at some point, the demon turns and starts reading Seika's mind, and he literally says, "Don't ever do that again." And then sends it back to the door. And it kind of reveals a little bit of a side of Seika, which was kind of fascinating. So the writer is kind of clever in the abilities and the spirits and stuff that he's using. But it's all kind of wrapped up into a typical story. The typical story is the hero and the demons are coming after the hero and they're starting to fight it. But I think there's enough clever and enough uniqueness in this that I think it does... This is easily my favorite of the quote-unquote reincarnated type of stories, not isekai type of stories, because it's doing so much different than what you typically get with most of these stories. Even with Kyle and the Evil Eye and his relationship with Mabel was kind of interesting. How he's using Amu as the hero to kind of keep the focus on her. All that stuff is doing enough. It's like I said, it's like a series that's doing enough to entertain me and enough different that I don't feel like I'm watching the same show again. So in that regard, it's definitely a recommendation if that's what you're looking for. Just expect that it does kind of have its fall and its lulling points. The CGI is terrible. They had a CGI dragon. It looked absolutely terrible. But other than that, it was interesting enough. So, yeah. The reincarnation of the strongest exorcist in another world. Sort of recommendation from Andrew. So, we'll see if it gets another season. Probably not, because I actually liked something about it, and that means it's not going to get a sequel. But I think it can go in interesting directions, even though I'm not completely on board with it. So, Inspector Season 2, me and Chris did not finish this, but we did watch the most important part, right? You at least watched the important part, right?
No, I only watched the first episode.
Oh, you didn't watch the best part then. He said something like the fact that he didn't watch all of it. And I'm like, okay, so I just assumed that he watched the Aoyuki part of it. I couldn't do it. Like, I this is a review from Andrew, who's literally watched 3 episodes of it. I watched the first, didn't like it. Second episode, it introduced the Yuki, and I was like, okay, I'm on board. I skipped an episode accidentally, but it worked out because the following episode was actually the conclusion of it, and it didn't do what I absolutely hate about the series, and I can't get over it. Which is essentially, it's about this girl that is essentially blessed by has become essentially the yokai princess, essentially. And she solved a lot of issues with the yokai, and then she's joined with this guy that has, like, the inability to die, and he's able to reach the conclusion. It's this weird thing that he has as well. And so they go through these little situations where yokai cause problems for humans. Typically, yokai come to her to solve the issue, and then she has to figure out what happened and what the resolve is. And I think my biggest issue that I have with it, and I end up kind of dropping it after the Yuki episode, is that I just absolutely hate that this writer likes to explain the problem, then explain the not resolve, and then explain the resolve. And it does it for like a span of multiple episodes. And it did that even with the Yuki one, but thankfully I skipped the episode that had the fake resolve, which felt completely useless when I went back and actually watched it. And so I decided to drop it. So I just can't. I want to love this series so much. And I wanted to love the first season so much. Most of the first season, I just really hated the last arc, but this one, I can't put my finger on it. I love Kotoko. She's fantastic. Kuro's fine. I personally can't do this storytelling. I can't figure it out. Like they were doing with the first episode too. They technically went this big explanation about a lie and then they tell you the truth. And it's like, why do we keep telling what is this pattern? And it's like the writer does it with everything they do.
I don't know. I think it maybe it's just more of a seeing things from different perspectives. It's an
but
odd
it's always
thing.
Her perspective.
I know it's funny because I know exactly what Andrew's talking about because I do see it. It doesn't bother me as much as it does him, but at the same time I can see why it's frustrating. It's one of those. It's long-winded and extremely long-winded. and it really will matter on whether or not you can, whether or not the characters per se are enough to offset that frustration of that long-windedness. Is the only way I can put it, I guess, maybe.
And that's why I think the Yuki one worked for me, is I loved the Yuki. The Yuki was gorgeous. I loved her character, and plus Aoyuki.
Yeah, when Andrew said asked me if because I had seen the first episode, and I said I don't know. It just did the one episode, and it seemed like I don't know. I didn't. Obviously, Andrew's saying that the second and third episode looks like they got right back into their old patterns.
Yeah, so. It was like the second episode was essentially introducing the Yukiona. It cuts to a different perspective. Like, it literally follows this one guy who is on this – he's ice climbing with his friend, and he nearly dies, and the Yukiona shows up and takes care of him. And then it cuts forward, and he literally is left his hometown to come back to the same area to live there because something bad happened. And he lost his job and everything. And as he's living there, he ends up running into the Yukiona again and starts to talk to her. And they start to form a relationship, and they hang out together, and she lives at his place. And then at some point, they find out his ex-wife's dead. And the police are showing up to interview him to find out, did he kill her? And then it goes to the following episode. The second episode of this arc is literally Kotoko comes there at the request of Yuki to try to solve this issue. And the whole second episode of this arc is literally Kotoko's telling a lie that she knows a lie. She's telling this big, long story about what happened. And then, like I said, that was the episode I skipped. The third episode of that arc is her then telling them what actually happened. It's like, what's the point of the second episode? Like, I couldn't figure out. Well, I mean, there's points to it, but it just doesn't feel like it's necessary in the end. And it feels like, I said, I watched the first part of that arc, then the third part of that arc, and then I went back and realized I missed the second part, and I watched the second part. And it really felt like it was a better story just doing that first episode and that third episode. Just be, let it be. That's all you had to do. But they had the second episode. And I was trying to figure out, why are they so angry? At some point it had a cutback, and it was like, wait, I didn't remember that part being in there, but that's me. I'm beating the dead horse. I love the characters. I love the stories when it's in certain sections, but the overall storytelling, I can't get into it, and I can't figure out why. I think it's because it feels like it spins its wheels purposely. I guess the best way I can put it. Anyways, yeah. At some point, she apparently says that she wants to do some kinky soap stuff with him, which the translators decided to completely. There was like this one. I end up seeing a screenshot, so I had to go check it out. There's like a section where she's talking about how the bath in this one place they're staying in is incredible, and she wants to do, what do they call it? Is it soap bottling or something like that? It's an actual term for like this fetish in Japan, which it's like one of those you know if you know kind of things. But she said it so, like, openly, and nobody reacted to it. It was supposed to be lost in absurdity or obscurity. Like, again, you don't know what it is unless you know. And so her yelling it out loud wouldn't shock anybody unless they knew what it was. And they just kind of just straight up translated as, I want him to clean out my hoo-hoo. I'm like, what? Wait. That's not what she said. Mm-hmm. Like, that's very blunt. And they would react to that. But yeah, she's her typical thirsty self. And that's what makes her really fun. So that's why I really want to enjoy it. I like her character.
I know. And she has such a perfect voice actress for it. And,
yeah.
And she's got just this fantastic artwork. So it is. I don't deny I push through a lot of the – because of her. I absolutely love her.
It's all because of her. Do it for the Kotoko.
I gotta go back. It's another one of those shows that I gotta catch up on.
All right, next is the Ice Guy and his cool female colleague. She's super cool. A series that follows a guy named Himuro, who is currently going to his new job, and on the way there, he's so full of anxiety that he's literally frozen in place because he's actually a descendant of the Ice Queen. And so whenever he gets emotional or has anxiety or something, it manifests in like snowstorms and stuff like that. They kind of really quickly establish the idea that this world has like mythological peoples and whatnot in it, and it seems normal. So this girl named Fuski, who ends up being his coworker, he finds out once he gets there, she comes walking by and she offers him some tea that she made beforehand that she's going to, you know, use for lunch. And it like relaxes him. Like they just stand there and relax for a little bit, that it soothes him enough that it melts away and he's able to actually go to work. But she doesn't seem to care about the fact that he's literally creating a snowstorm. Everybody seems to be perfectly natural with it. And then when they get there, we find out like the boss is like a descendant of Buddha. And then you have like, this one girl's a fox girl and this other guy's a phoenix. So it's, again, it seems to be natural in this world. But most of the focus is on the idea that you have this Himuro, who again is the descendant of the Ice Queen. So all of his emotions manifest snowstorms and stuff. And his cool female colleague, who he really likes because she's got this cool nature about her. And the idea that for the majority, for a lot of the sequences of the series, it's really kind of his insecurities and difficulties he's facing. And the fact that Fuski, this coworker, often helps him along with those issues that he's facing, you know, finds a resolve for it. She actually goes out of her way to find something that will help him with it. So when his when the company is going to a meeting at this resort, beachside resort, he's kind of afraid of the idea that he's going to get there and he's going to cause this snowstorm and ruin the entire area for everybody by creating a snowstorm and ruining the beach and everything. So she kind of puts together these things that can help him kind of train himself not to, you know, cause issues once he gets there. So that's kind of the cool nature of her, besides the fact that she's kind of cool. A little bit on the side, you have like some other relationships that are kind of forming, like Shijima, who is kind of interested in the fox girl, and yeah, the phoenix guy, he's like obsessed with this Otanashi girl. Seeing these like three different pairings that are in the story that all kind of come and meet each other and find the oddities about each other and how to overcome them. So, but most of the focus is on Himuro and Fuski, which is really cool. So my thoughts on the show, very simple show. It is kind of one of those quote unquote perfect waifu type of shows because Fuski is literally perfect. One of the few cases where I'm like, yep, I agree. She's great. I love her to death. But the concept that it presents is like, yes, the supernatural element that kind of twists this idea of just kind of work-life relationships that you kind of feel is kind of similar to something like Love is Hard for an Otaku. That idea where you have these coworkers that all game and they come together and have relationships amongst their work environment. It's kind of that simple, that same concept. But this one feels a lot more skit-based where it's like, suddenly, okay, here's this problem that Himuro's facing. Fuski solves it. Here's the next problem Himuro is facing. Fuski solves it. And it kind of feels a little bit repetitive in that regard, but for the most part, I really do like the chemistry of the characters themselves, and I like the relationships that are kind of forming over time. It's just one of those ones that's like relationship building in a work environment, but it's not trying too hard with getting some extremely deep emotional context with the characters. They're not facing difficult trials that are really kind of pushing the limits of drama. It's just kind of very simple stuff. They do get a little bit in some heart heavier stuff later on with like Himuro and him getting like really sick. Whenever he gets like super sick or whatever, or it gets too hot, he shrinks into a little kid, which opens a lot of doors to the Shota crowd. But it's kind of respectful with it. But it kind of gets into the whole aspect of his insecurities and how he overworks himself and stuff. So it dabbles into some heavy stuff. But for the most part, it's very surface level relationship building between these characters. And it's simple enough that it's enjoyable. I actually did find myself really enjoying the series overall just because the chemistry works out so well between the characters. We'll say very unique style with the show itself. I've never seen this before in any other show, so Chris can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've never seen a show that has so much emphasis on eyes. If you ever kind of know whenever somebody's like really close to you, whatever, or you watch a romance or something, you usually kind of see the characters where they're almost looking at the other person's each eye. And so you'll kind of see that very, very subtle shift left and right of the eyes themselves. And they kind of did this a lot with the show. Like this seemed to be like their thing. And I'm not sure how that translated from the manga or if it's just something they decided to do with the show, but just so much rapid eye movement, so to speak, not rapid eye movement, but that kind of subtle shifting back and forth, especially with Fuski, which I thought was kind of really interesting and almost added in a little bit of element of detail that I actually really liked. So oddity that I really did enjoy in it. I don't think I noticed it with any of the other characters, but except for Fuski. So yeah.
Closest I could think of is Rabbit, but that wasn't so much in, in the actual eye movement. It was just the focus on the actual eyes themselves.
Yeah, like, overall, like, anime loves highly detailed eyes. I mean, there's that big old controversy about, like, him paying, like, large amounts just to pay, just to, like, the animators are getting killed by just having to animate eyes because the production is putting so much emphasis on the eyes looking really gorgeous, because I think they just feel like that's a selling point for a lot of these characters. But specifically, that movement was just very unique with this one that I thought was kind of odd. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. It's not incredible. It's not deep, heavy stuff, but it's definitely one of those things that's filling that gap of what a lot of people have kind of asked me about, is like, where's these coworker environment romance shows? Well, this is kind of one of them, but it's just not, it's not super heavy, and it's not technically reality because it's got that supernatural element, but it is technically slice of life. So I recommend it if that's what you're looking for. It's cute. I enjoyed it.
I might go and check it out just because of the eyes.
The eyes, yes. The eyes. I'm going to say Yatsura 2022 edition. Yeah, this happened. Of course, we have another core coming up here soon. I think it's supposed to be in summer, question mark? I think they were taking a two-season break, so that would make sense if it was summer. But it's coming back. But for the first season, which was 23 episodes, I believe, of course, following Ataru, who is this guy that's just a womanizer. He's always chasing tail constantly. He's got this girl that he likes, Shinobu, but then he quickly, you know, gets distracted and chases after another girl and gets punched. At some point, he comes home to find, like, a whole bunch of people there. Apparently, the government's kind of swooping in and everything, because come to find out, he was randomly chosen throughout all the people of the world to compete against the aliens on whether or not they're going to take over the Earth or not. And his task is to touch the horns of Lum, who is the big cheese alien guy's daughter. And so he has to chase her down, and he's given, like, a certain amount of time. And so he has to somehow touch her horns. But the unfortunate thing is that she can zap him and she can fly. So that makes it very difficult for a random human to actually do it. But he pulls it off, and at the same time talks about wanting to marry somebody at the same time of doing it. And so Lum assumes he was talking about her, not Shinobu, who basically professed that she would marry him if he pulled it off. And so, yeah, Lum assumes that Atoru wants to marry her, so that she's pretty much always chasing him around that, hey, wait, honey, what are you doing? You're not supposed to be chasing after Shinobu. We're married. And that kind of becomes the joke as they has Lum trying to pursue Atoru, which I don't understand why he doesn't like her so much. She's great. But it's a main character. They have to dither. Main character's got to dither. And they just kind of introduce a bunch of characters, a lot of different aliens from different worlds and snow queens and all these other characters, this rich guy named Shutaro who is trying to get Lum. It's just like this big, massive spider web of relationships all kind of circling around Ataru in some way, shape, or form. So, and that really is kind of what a lot of this first season kind of felt like, was just kind of hitting all those introductions, which that's kind of what they were insinuating with the adaptation, this new adaptation. Of course, they adapted it a long time ago. This is a very old manga. I think it's like 78. Super old. Super old manga. Done by Rumiko Takahashi, of course, is known for doing Inuyasha, Ranma 1/2, Mason Kakaku, Ikaku. It's kind of one of those very old comedies. And this is all to build up to a point, by the way. So stick with me here. This is a very old manga, and they were doing another adaptation of it, because it's been adapted before. And this new adaptation, their focus was to pretty much cut out the fat of the manga, but adapt all the key parts of the manga itself, because it's a very long manga. I think the original anime adaptation was like 100 episodes or something like that. It was super long. So what you kind of get is the result is they're introducing all the characters. And so every episode, and sometimes every half episode, they're introducing another character. So it's just kind of amassing this massive, very massive cast of characters. And it almost feels like you don't really have a moment to really breathe and interact with those specific characters after they're introduced, because it quickly shifts to the next character. And so that becomes like one of two really key problems that I feel with this adaptation, this new adaptation, is it just feels like it's all over the place and it never really takes the moment to really have fun with those characters, just constantly introduce new ones. The other issue that it has is that it's kind of, for lack of a better term, it's kind of neutered in a way. The unfortunate thing that comes with the new adaptation is sort of changing the sensitivities of the adaptation itself, because the original manga is kind of lewd in certain regards. There's a lot of nudity and whatnot in it. And with the original anime adaptation, they were fine with showing a lot of you know, the nudity, the TNA and everything like that. With this one, they literally cut it all out. And that's the unfortunate thing, is because that's kind of part of the comedy of Urusei Yatsura, is that juvenile look of nudity and stuff like that. It just kind of happens and the characters panic and then it kind of moves on, or a character gets punched. It's just not even here. It's like they completely remove it. They reference it with the iconic moment of Ataru stealing her bra and then her panicking over it and him being able to grab the horns. But after that, like, it's literally not there. Like, it's just non-existent. And it almost feels like a part of the humor of the series is kind of completely removed because of that. They're still hitting the key points in the humor, and that humor is going to work for some people and not others. It's a very old style of humor. It kind of works for me because I have that nostalgia of watching the original series a long time ago. But it's going to be, probably for new anime fans, probably not something they're going to really care about because it is, let's face it, dated. All that said, David Productions, fantastic job adapting it, because it visually looks absolutely amazing. Music and the voicing choices. Lum's Seiyu is absolutely fantastic. She just grabbed my heart. Like, the moment Lum shows up and she says her little state, introduce herself and does the chop, I was like, got me. Doki Doki got me again. Like, I loved Lum back in the day, and then immediately the new Lum just grabbed me immediately. So it still has its charm. The Seiyu choices are fantastic. Ataru's Seiyu, obviously, with Araragi. The Seiyu choices are fantastic. And Shinobu is Lily from Danmachi. Great choices. Love them all. I will say that there's certain characters that in the original one I don't think I liked too much that I actually liked this one, like Ran. I don't think I liked her at all back in the day, and I really loved her character. Shutaro's sister, I think, was one of the funniest episodes in later parts. It's got a bit of absurdity, and a lot of that absurdity that we've kind of lost over the decades. But at the same time, I admit, it's dated and it's kind of censored in a way. It's changed in order to fit standard Japanese television, which, yes, technically doesn't allow a lot of that kind of stuff anymore. As much as we want to claim we're censoring it, it's technically there as well. It's that whole difficulty there that I think kind of ruins its charm, which, yes, you can say is inappropriate. It's still a charm that it had that's kind of lost. So either way, I still really enjoyed it. Had a lot of really fantastic episodes. There was some flop episodes, like Shutaro and the whole, you know, the first introduction to the fact that he's afraid whenever he doesn't see anybody else and he's in the dark, he panics and acts like a total ranting child was absolutely hilarious. And like I said, his sister is nuts with her crush and how she's chucking grenades to make him blow up and come back to her and stuff. It's just, she's a dork. It's still got a lot of charm in there. I still love Lum. But, yeah. What do you think? Because you watched at least the first core, right?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was doing absolutely fantastic. I do agree with you on the change of sensibilities. It is frustrating to... How do I put it? Because it would be like the same thing with Tenchi.
Yeah, can you imagine Tenchi being...
redoing
that's my
Tenchi
argument. I was saying, at this point, I don't want them to redo Ranma. I think that was one of those things I've always kind of wanted, for somebody to redo Ranma. But I'm like, no, if this is how they're going to handle it, I don't want it. Heck yeah, no, not
the,
Ranma.
The old style of humor is... Nothing is really sacred. It's not necessarily that you have to go full on. It's just that like I've talked about before with the whole ecchi thing, is... Ecchi is not complete hentai. Ecchi is just that naughty, you know, just a little bit, right there on the edge. Not necessarily pushing it past, but just, it's there. It's part of life. You're going to have it. Move on. And that's what makes that kind of humor work, is that, oh, I see where you were going there, but not necessarily going there. Is the point. And I hate the idea of losing that kind of honestly adult humor without actually just flat out turning it into a hentai. That is the thing. But I rant aside, I agree. That's one thing that is kind of frustrating. You know, if you have the idea of
how those shows flow, you know what we're talking about, because you can kind of feel that something's off about the humor here. It should be there, but you're not really quite sure because maybe you didn't watch Urusei Yatsura back in the day. But you know, you almost feel like there should be, because Ataru is, he's a playboy. Obviously, he's driven by something. You've got Lum, who's practically in a bathing suit all day, all night. And
Tiger
then,
stripe, too.
Yeah, and so you obviously know this humor is there. It screams that this is what that kind of the basis for most of the humor in this show, but it's not there. And so it kind of feels vanilla-ish in a lot of ways. I mean, a lot of the other outside humor is still there. But you do know that there's a lot of humor that does seem like it's been pulled out. So, yeah.
I think the way you put it is kind of interesting. And I would kind of expand on the idea that this isn't – what we're talking about with the slips and stuff like that is not necessarily – it's not an Inukai-san dog type of thing. With Inukai-san dog, what they're doing there specifically is saying, look at it. Look at it. Get close and look at it and laugh as you're looking at it. That is that type of style. That's not what the original Urusei Yatsura is and what those older style animes was. Those older style animes were more of a, oops, move on. Like, something just slipped off. And you panicked for a second, somebody got punched, and then you moved on. It wasn't a look at it and get a close-up and get, you know, turn on about it. It was just like, it was a slip, and somebody laughs about it, and you move on kind of thing. Just like Rama 1/2, he suddenly gets in different temperature water, and suddenly something's showing that wasn't there before. They cover it up, and they move on. It was a part of the comedy, and yes, you kind of say it's kind of a juvenile adult type of comedy. It was just a comedy itself, because it was always a, you seen it, didn't you? You giggle and you move on, kind of thing. So, anyways, that's enough beating that dead horse.
Beat that dead horse. Kill it. Kill it.
Ningen Fushien, adventurers who don't believe in humanity will save the world. World. I don't even want to talk about this show. It was done by Geek Toys, which is not a good studio. Never going to be a good studio, I don't think, at this point. I'm just giving up on Geek Toys. It basically has these four party members that, well, they're four people that were part of other parties or other groups or whatever that all get kind of betrayed by somebody or their party or a friend or a loved one. And they all come together at this one bar. They're forced to sit in the same table because they don't have any other tables available. And then they just start kind of divulging their issues, their lives to each other. And they decide at that point to become their own party. A party of rejects, basically, that will, as the title leads you to believe, and the narrator at the first episode says, save the world. And it's kind of their trials as they are a party together. They don't trust each other, obviously, because they've got trust issues at this point, and how they kind of have to work over those mistrusting aspects of each other, while also keeping rules in check that kind of keep each other in check, just so that they never have to run into that problem again, is sort of the gist of it early on. Eventually, they find this OP weapon. Then they go and they have to solve this crime of this kidnapper, killer, and yeah, weird stuff happens at the end. How much did you watch any of this?
Yeah, up till the weapon.
Oh, the weapon?
And the
fusing
and
weapon?
And the end of that episode, they said, this is where it really all starts. And it's like, okay.
Well, I'm excited to see where it goes from here. Typically, when I hear that, I go, ooh, goody, it's a prequel. Let's get into it. It was like I gathered that. That's where they all start somewhere. God, where do I start with this show? It looks like butt, first off, foremost. I don't understand the world, and I don't think they ever will explain the world. It just feels like an oddity world where I'm of two minds. Either the labyrinths themselves are like multidimensional, and thus there's oddities of different worlds in each of the labyrinths, and that's what makes it so weird. Or this is a post-apocalyptic world where it's used to be a modern times, and thus there's still ruins of old buildings and stuff, places, and for some reason fluorescent ceiling lamps inside of dungeons. I don't understand why there's like idols with glow sticks and fluorescent lights in labyrinths and basically a slums area that looks like New York if it was flooded. I don't get the aesthetic. The overall aesthetic makes no sense to me, and I never gathered a point where I'm like, oh, now it suddenly all makes sense. Maybe later down the road to explain that stuff, but for now it's like, you got to get over very quickly the fact that this opening show shows him get broke up by his girlfriend and then literally cuts to him waving glowy sticks at an idol on a stage performance. I don't know. That aside, it's basically about jaded adventurers coming together to yell at each other, I guess, and eventually solve a crime.
That's really what it is. I mean, when it comes down to it, it's a bunch of jaded quote-unquote heroes, because I don't really think the priest guy is a hero, but when it comes down to it, they just get together and they just start getting mad at each other, because that's all they do, is they get mad at each other and they don't trust each other and they don't like each other.
Yeah, Tanya shoots at a boss and Karan has to dodge it because she's in the front line, and then she suddenly says, I'll never turn my back to you, and then later, like 10 minutes later, she turns back to her because she trusts her suddenly. It's my main problem, like, putting aside the visuals, but I don't think it looks good at all, and it's got a lot of very wonky moments in it. Putting aside the visuals and the aesthetic of the world, it makes no sense to me. At its core, I don't like this writing. This writing feels very, very lazy. Like, the first episode, we open up with seeing Nick was basically being strung along by this girl just so that she can get stuff from him, and then she breaks up with him, and he's mad. And Tiana sort of makes sense in the idea that she was this prodigy genius. She's doing very well in her skills, and then you have this jealousy that's happening, and then eventually her quote-unquote boyfriend breaks up with her because, I don't know, she was supposedly mean to the other girl. I don't know. And that she's possibly, doing promiscuous things in order to get high rankings in her class, which completely ruins the teacher's life. And then it cuts over to the priest guy, and he apparently was working at this one village, and at some point this little girl got interested in him, and he told her, look, I can't do that, you're too young. And then she tells everybody that he was touching her, and thus they immediately say that it's true, that she's not lying, and throws him in jail. And then Karan just has a jerk of a party leader that steals all of her stuff. That's literally, they established that in the first two episodes, and it's like, every one of these stories feels so... It just feels simple and sort of cheesy and almost just kind of lazy. It just all for the sake of saying this entire world's full of nasty people, and it was a big massive shrug, and I rolled my eyes at it most of the time. So I just feel like a lot of the writing itself is just kind of lazy and almost offensive when I watched it.
Well, when I went through the first couple of episodes, I gave it a lot of leeway. I was like, okay, most of this is just set up. Okay, we can get into their characters a little bit deeper later. I don't care. Really what kind of ruined it, finished it off for me, let's put it that way, was literally the weapon, if you want to give it that. It is like they did that. Because that was pretty much the first story beat, if you want to give it anything, is them actually getting together. Okay, now they've set up. Okay, you got this garbage backstory for everybody, whatever. But then they go and get this weapon, and it fell flat on its face. And then them turn around and say, well, this is where it all starts. And it was like, no. I really don't care. And this is literally one of them that I was like, I'm not even going
to
try.
And it sucks, though, because I think when we did our previews, we were both decently excited for this idea of, like, these jaded adventurers coming together and saving the world. And it had a really cool concept that the better title is apparently Disillusioned Adventurers Save the World. It makes more sense, that idea, than just kind of being... losing hope, but at the same time coming together to actually do a common goal. And I was hoping it'd be one of those aspects where I was more hoping that it would be an aspect that they themselves were sort of the fault of their own demise. Like, Tiana she sort of believes that there's a possibility she's the cause of it, but the rest of them, it's literally like a one-sided thing where somebody just betrayed them and they trusted them and they come together. And I was hoping it'd be a thing where as they went along, it'd be them going, oh, yeah, I am sort of the reason why I had an issue with my previous party, and it's sort of affecting my new party now, and they have to come to terms with that and fight a common goal. But it never feels like that. It just feels sloppy, and then it gets into weird boxing matches and math boxing class. I don't get that. It's like one, they had the two over there, and they're doing that test. And depending on how fast they finish the test, they stop punching each other. It was weird. It's all weird. It makes no sense. It's just a weird world. I think if it was better animated and presented, I probably would have liked how weird it is. But it just, everything just frustrated me that I didn't want to bother giving a chance. Even though it's got some good characters in there. Like, Kuron's super cute, and I like Tiana, but yeah, I feel bad for Zim because it's kind of a stupid situation. Like, yeah, they have ways of checking that. Even back then, I guess I don't know when it was, but I don't know. It's just stupid. It's a stupid show. And I feel bad for having watched it. Anyways, that's Ning and Fusion. Don't watch it. Buddy Daddies. Here, let's get a fun show. Buddy Daddies. Buddy Daddies done by PA Works. It's basically Spy Family. Moving on. No, I'm joking. It's a good Spy Family. I'm going to get more people mad with that comment. No, this one opens up with Kazuki and Rei, and they are basically hired hitmen. They'll take down nasty people. They only kill bad people. It's like the True Lies thing. They were all bad. They're assassins that kill all bad people. But no, they're hired people that go out and take out bad people that are doing really annoying things for this organization. And then at some point, as they kill they're going to kill this one guy, this one target who's doing like human trafficking and stuff. Kazuki, who's going in to infiltrate first, ends up running into this girl named Miri, and she really likes the cake that he baked, which makes him really happy because his partner, Rei, never appreciates what he cooks. But no, this Miri girl really likes his cake, and then come to find out after they kill this guy, that their target is, oh yeah, by the way, that's her dad. So you just made her an orphan. So they start taking care of her, and they're trying to figure out where her mom is. They eventually track her down, and that kind of just blows up in their faces. But it's just basic. They're doing hitman jobs, while at the same time having to take care of Meaty, trying to figure out what they're going to do with Meaty. While at the same time, Meaty keeps messing up a lot of their jobs. And, yeah, that's basically the concept. So how much of this do you watch?
None.
Oh, that's a big shocker. I would assume that you at least watched the first.
Never did get around to it.
Oh, that sucks. This is probably going to be another one that's eventually you're going to get back to it. It's super cute. Midi's super great. No, I joked about it, but it's technically it's an obvious thing. This is obviously PA Works, an original title. Let's be perfectly honest. It was created at the offset of how popular Spy X Family was. What is Spy X Family? It's a killer and a spy that take on a daughter who's super cute. And the daughter sometimes gets involved with the stuff they're doing. Same concept here. Two assassins, they do jobs, cute little daughter that comes into play, and she gets involved with them every now and then. It's just throwing an innocence in with this whole concept. The only key thing, a big difference I would say with this one is that it is an action comedy. It feels almost as if they're not apologetic with the violence. Like, they're still shooting people. People are getting shot left and right. So it still has that, but it never dwells on it to make it super heavy. So you do have a shootout. People are getting shot, but it has a comedic aspect to it where they're running away and there's there's stormtrooper levels of bullets flying everywhere. None of them are hitting them. But I think the way they incorporated Meaty, it's much more family-centric. Well, yes, Spy Family is family-centric. They almost feel separated. Like, if you follow, if an episode's about Anya, it's going to be just Anya. If it's an episode with God, I'm blanking on his name.
Lloyd.
I knew it started with an L. I almost said Leon.
Lloyd Forger.
Lloyd Forger. When it's a Lloyd Forger episode, Forger. Zoinks. A Lloyd episode.
Andrew blew
it's
up.
It's just him. It's just one of those things where you say it wrong the first time and you'll never get it right. Just stop. You're never going to say it right again. I do that with Mushoku Mondays all the time, and that's what my blooper sections are for. But it's so focused on an individual character, and it barely ever has them all come together at the same episode, which is weird. This one is so focused on them being involved with each other, whether it's Rei with Meaty, Kazuki with Meaty, or Rei and Kazuki together. They're so relationship-focused. And I think that's what helped this show for me, sell me so much on this odd group coming together to make technically a family. And the way they spelled it out was so great. I loved Midi. I love how she softens the heart of Rei and Kazuki. It feels very well wrote, because Rei is especially somebody that just doesn't... He doesn't get emotional. He doesn't connect with things. He just plays his games, goes and does his job, goes back and plays his game. He's technically like a neat assassin. Whereas Kazuki is more the type of trying to help, but at the same time having his own scars from his past, having his past relationship that was kind of just blew up in his face. You have that fear of quote-unquote hitman that are... You have that fear of hitman taking upon themselves a life. Like, right in the first episode, Rei has a cat in the house. And Kazuki's like, you don't bring things like this into the house. You don't bring stuff like that into your life because it's going to get swept up in your own life and it's going to end up dead based on his own inner experiences. And now suddenly Midi's in the house. And they're having that conflict with the fact that Midi could become a target because they are taking down targets, and that will eventually make the wrong person mad. And I like how they kind of encompass that whole aspect of something you want to nurture, something you want to have in your life, but yet you can't have it. And I think it was all just kind of played out well in the idea that I like these characters, I like how they're wrote, and I think Midi adds a very nice, innocent nature to it, while at the same time being a very loud and very attention-needing little girl. I remember seeing some people complain that they don't like how loud Midi is. I'm like, that's a kid. I don't think it drags it out too much. There was a couple scenes early on where it was like, yeah, we're dragging out this scene of her running around giggling a little bit too long. Let's move things on kind of thing. But it still encompasses that aspect of the innocence for her. So, and it does some really good stuff later on. I will admit, the final conclusion of the big epic situation that they have at the very end, I thought was a little bit of a letdown. Like, it's that's the only part where I'm like, yeah, I don't see that happening. But it was still it still had a very pleasing ending to it. Like, it was an ending that I smiled to, and that's pretty much all I asked for it. So I was really half expecting this to go a 2-core, because that's typically what PA Works does, is they do 2-cores, time jump, 2-core kind of thing. But like I said, I think it was fine as a single core. Like, they told the story they needed to tell. They got a solid wrap up in the end, and it concluded very, very pleasing. So
it's okay. You will get your time jump second core.
Well, they technically did.
Next year.
They did it. Yeah, they could. Buddy Daddies too. Meaty the Assassin. That was what everybody was thinking it was going to go, the direction it was going to go. It's going to Meaty the Assassin. It could have. I'm not saying it didn't go the route of Meaty becoming an assassin, but it could. It could have not. I don't know. It was good, though. I enjoyed it more than the Spy Family's Core 2, and that's saying something. I really enjoy Season 1, or Core 1 of Spy Family, by the way. Danmachi, Season 4, Part 2. Did you get a chance to finish it?
I didn't even get to start it.
Oh, like, you got Part 1, didn't you?
Yeah, I got
Part 1. That was summer, I think.
Yeah, the last episode I seen was a very, very horrible.
He's a bad spot to leave.
It is an absolute horrible place.
I jumped right in that second park so fast because it's like, why did you leave it there? Chris is still cooking. But no, for those who don't know, Danmachi basically about this big pillar, this dungeon in the middle, and it's got these gods and goddesses that come down to the earth to be with the humans. They give up their powers to live amongst the humans. They create familia, which are basically like guilds. So you have our main characters, Bell. He's part of the Hestia family, which is just one goddess that, you know, kind of runs that particular guild, which is basically just them two for the longest time. Getting into Season 4, though, I will say, like, a really great change. I'm not going to get too much into the story stuff, by the way, because we're 4 seasons in. Technically 5, if you say that a split core makes a different season. We've gotten to the point now where I was almost thinking of not watching Danmachi anymore. Like, season one was good. Season 2, okay. Season 3 was starting to really badly lose me. It just felt like the title leads you to believe. It's just him getting another harem member. Every core is, here's a new harem character. Bell's going to save them. They devote themselves to Bell. Really losing a lot of the fantasy and dungeon diving aspects that kind of initially drew me into the series. I will say, and it's answered by a lot of people when the season first started, the reason why it feels like the season has picked up so much is apparently the writer being more involved with the actual adaptation. And I felt that with season four starting off, it's just like suddenly out of nowhere, I'm like, I love this series again. Like, it suddenly feels good again. Like, it feels good. And yeah, technically getting very heavy with the storytelling with this particular season, getting into some really bad situations with Belle and Party, getting into a very deep part of the dungeon, getting faced with death itself. And I really loved it. And it sucked that the part one and part two were so separate because it had a really nasty cliffhanger. But going into the second part, it just kept getting better. Like, I loved the first part because it had like a really great moment with Lily, her fighting with everybody else, them all standing up, Haruhime getting a new ability and really kind of standing up as well. But part two was just absolute dread nonstop. Like, it just felt like this writer suddenly was like, all right, here's a gut punch. Okay, you punched me already. You don't have to keep pressing my stomach. No, I'm still punching you. They nailed the dread of what they were technically doing. Because like I said, you technically have these characters are in a very deep part of the labyrinth and or the dungeon. And it feels like every fight is their last. It nailed that portrayal. Every time another one of these little sheep skeleton things showed up in front of Belle, I'm like, how the hell is he going to manage this one? Because he barely got the last one. It's like they were constantly at the edge of the cliff. And I like how it portrayed that, and it made me feel like I was constantly dreading what was going to be around the next door corner. The atmosphere of the deeper floors and what it really does to the mental state of the characters. Belle literally losing himself. Like, he's literally gone into despair, and that's something I've never really seen Belle do before. Maybe momentarily, like in the first episode when he first gets the Minotaur in front of him, but this is literally the most broken Belle I've ever seen. And how the two of them kind of pulling themselves along through the story was fantastic. Two criticisms, though. I will give two decently significant criticisms of this part two, and it kind of lays into the fourth season overall. Ryu's story, we already kind of knew what it was. Like, we kept hearing people talk about what happened to Ryu in her past party and her seeking revenge. I didn't need to see it. And it really felt like they were trying to, after the fact, show me her relationship with each of the members of the party. And I don't know if maybe the novel series is a lot more in-depth with that relationship that she has with each individual one. But this one just felt like, okay, cut back to the past. Now we're going to show her talking to this one character. And they're just basically all talking about their individual thoughts of justice. It was stupid. It felt like a waste of time. And it all came to the big moment where you get to see how it all kind of unfolded and she lost her party members. I just didn't care at that point. So that felt like a loss. And I really did feel like the ending, how things kind of wrapped up with the season, felt very anticlimactic. And it felt like it kind of spit in the face of everything it built up to that point. It felt way too easy. It just felt like a shrug, move on. Like, everything kind of wrapped up. We're done. And it's like, okay, that felt very... That didn't feel very satisfying at all. But other than that, it's great. Visually, sound, character moments, all that other stuff was absolutely fantastic. The dread of that dungeon was super good. So, loved it.
Yeah, building up to the ending of the first part, I can only imagine the second part would have been absolutely fantastic.
Doesn't let up. Just doesn't let up. Tomo-chan is a girl is her next one. This is on Crunchyroll for 13 episodes. Basically follows Tomo, who is a girl, by the way. Tomo is in love with her childhood friend, Jun. But the problem is, after they kind of got reunited after a period of time, she confesses to him and he literally goes, yeah, I like you too. The joke is that he thinks Tomo is a boy. And so he doesn't get it that she's literally a girl and she wants to be romantic with him. That joke's kind of kicked away very quickly as you realize that Jun does know that Tomo is a girl. They established in the first episode, by the way. He establishes that he does know that Tomo is a girl. It's just that he doesn't want to break that facade because he wants to remain her friend. And he feels that if they get in a relationship, that can kind of ruin that. So he just kind of just wants to keep things as they are, as they're buddies and everything. We quickly get rejoined by the other childhood friend of this particular group of three, which is Misusu, who has always had a lot of fun tormenting the hell out of June, which is absolutely fantastic, and she's hilarious by that regard. Eventually, they have a transfer student, Carol, who's, like, super ganky and bubbly and kind of ditzy. And one of Tomo's senpais in her karate class, who is trying to become stronger to protect Carol, and so on and so forth. So, how much of this did you watch?
None?
That could be another one to put in your list of if you can kind of shows. I actually really like the show, despite the fact that, especially early on, I didn't really care about the main couple. Like, I got the joke early on. Tomo wants to be seen as a girl. She's voiced by Rie Takahashi, so I obviously really love her voice. But I just really didn't care for the pairing there, like June and Tomo, and how they constantly have to be beating each other up, and they just want to be the bros, and Tomo wants to be seen as a girl, but yeah, she's always running around broad-shouldered and wearing guy-type clothing, outfits and stuff like that, not really showing femininity and stuff like that. Their relationship I didn't really care about. The thing that kind of grabbed me early on was Mizusu. Mizusu, I think I told you this in the first impression or something. Mizusu is literally the archetype that I don't like, that you typically like. It's the conniving girl on the side that's always kind of doing these nasty things that kind of is more of a teasy aspect. It's just to tease and trick people, but it's not like super malicious. I don't typically like that type of character, but I loved Mizusu. I loved her chemistry with the individual characters. I just didn't care for June and Tomo. Their concept was established early on, and I didn't really think they did much to really manipulate that. It was always what Mizusu was doing to manipulate the situation. And I like how it actually gets into a story beat later. But no, Mizusu's always kind of on the sideline, constantly, you know, making fun of June. And June would always kind of retort by just kind of doing some petty thing to her. Like, the earlier moments where you have that reveal that June does know that Tomo is a girl. And he's like, well, I just don't want to break that kind of thing. And she's like, well, if you don't, then eventually she's suddenly going to show up with another guy. What are you going to do about that? And he literally just pushes her. They're waiting in the shade of the school, and it's pouring down rain. They're waiting for Tomo. And he literally just pushes her out in the rain. And she just turns and looks at him as she's getting soaked. It's just so petty. Later on, she makes some snarky comment while she's sitting in her desk, and he just comes over, and he just takes off her scrunchie and chucks it. It's like this stupid, this is the most petty, stupid thing, but it's hilarious in that regard. And she always just stands there and stares at him like, you just did that. They're great. And then when they introduced Carol, she was super fun. She did seem overly bubbly, ganky, doofus-like. Then eventually you realize, no, she's actually really smart, and I really loved her character later on. That's the thing I would probably give this writer the most credit for, is it opens up with the concept of a dumb little quirk. Tomboy girl trying to get guy to see her as a girl. And then Mizusu's sitting there and trying to introduce all these things that can make Tomo more feminine, but none of them ever seem to work. But it all comes to these really great character intertwining that they do in the later part that I was absolutely blown away with. And it's what made me eventually love the pairing of Tomo and June, is how all these characters eventually in the end intertwine to either raise each other up or accent each other in a way that makes their ultimate character development in the end fantastic. Like I said, Mizusu is sitting there messing with them the whole time, and then it turns into a story beat at the end that was really, really powerful. Carol and the fact that she's super bubbly, but then in the end you kind of get the whole side of her story and her insecurities. Misaki and his relationship, it all kind of culminates in the end to make a really amazing ending. I give this writer so much credit for having such a satisfying ending for all the characters in the end, despite the fact of it opening up with a dumb, quirky romance type of thing. It's kind of one of those rom-coms that, in a rare case, is super satisfying in the end, but it's satisfying for all the characters. And I give them a massive amount of credit for that. So, I think I said that already. But, yeah, in the end, loved it. Didn't start out loving it, besides Mizusu, but in the end, absolutely loved it. So, I highly recommend it, especially if you like romance comedies. It's definitely up there, and it, unlike most romance comedies, is very satisfying in the end for all the characters. It's one of the rare cases where you're like, oh, this feels really good when it concludes. So, where that's typically not the case. All right, Chris. Chilling in my 30s after getting fired from the Demon King's army. ran for 12 episodes, done by Crunchyroll. Not done by Crunchyroll. Might as well be done by Crunchyroll. It didn't look that bad. No, it was on Crunchyroll. This one done by Encouragement Films, which, there you go. There's the person you want to throw your rocks at. But no, it's opens up with this guy getting fired from the Demon Lord's army, or Demon King's army. He then has to figure out what he's going to do with the rest of his life. He thinks he's a demon. He really quickly finds out that he's not actually a demon. He's actually human. He goes to this village where he goes to near to a village, saves some girl. She ends up dragging him into the village and then proceeds to use her chest, or at least the fact that she asks him to do things and she has a chest in front of her. He constantly helps her out with stuff. And, he liberates a mine and, he joins the Adventure Guild and he's OP in all attributes because he's a main character. And, that's about as far as I got. And then, oh yeah, they started whispering that they want him to come back to the Demon King army because he was doing a really good job, which typically is how it works.
Yeah, they got married too. Had a baby.
That's worth watching.
There you go, Andrew. You've always said you wanted to play.
That's like one of those things where somebody, like, I never hear a peep about this show. And then suddenly when that happens, it's like, everybody's like, holy crap, they did this. And it's like, that's your only selling point is that suddenly out of nowhere, cut scene and there was a baby in an arm. You got some low standards, people. Just doesn't need it that bad.
I mean, I thought it was a fine show. I'm not going to scream from the rooftops that it was it was doing anything fantastic. It did what it did. Its story.
It did what it did. That's pretty much the description of every anime. It did what it did.
It did what it did.
Hey, Pupa. It did what it did.
About the more interesting things in this show is probably more the ideal of him being in the middle of these two factions. And I think that is probably its strongest selling point, is him being in the middle of these two factions. He wants to protect his small town. And so that by that natural aspect, he does inadvertently kind of side with the humans, but he does have a love for his, where he came from in the demon army. While he does have this spurning, he does still love a lot of the people in the Demon King's army. And he does have his knowledge from that faction as well. So this gives him this interesting placement in the world. And that does come into more the forefront later on as you get into his backstory and why he is in the Demon King army and all that aspect. So it does have its interesting aspects, but is it enough to bring it out of the fray of the mire? Is this a diamond in the rough? No, it's not. It is, like I said at the beginning, it does what it does. It's not doing anything special. It does have some cute characters. It does have some goofy hijinks here and there. But it doesn't have anything that I can go, man, this is really awesome. It just... It's got the opi on the screen.
I was about to say, it's very inappropriate that you would claim that her chest, the two of her chest, is the two very interesting characters. They're not. You don't classify them as characters.
There's more interesting characters later on when the hero comes in and she brings her assets to the screen and one of the, like Andrew said, the whispering in the background when one of those characters comes into the forefront and brings her assets. I mean, there's a lot of characters involved in this.
Yeah, though my big joke was the fact that Encouragement Films didn't want to animate really any of this show. Like the first encounter between
To save it for the other two characters later, Andrew.
Dariel's first encounter with Marika and him saving her was like, you animated none of that fight. I don't even know what happened. And then it like literally cuts to her chest and I'm like, never mind, that's where the animation is put. Literally, it felt like that for the first like two, what, I don't know if I watched two or three episodes. But it just felt like those three episodes, the only thing they were really animated was that chest. Every time, like, every 2 seconds. And it's, like, not even shying for the fact that he's constantly just staring at it. It's like it's air. Hey, we need you to do this. Huh? What are we saying? Your two characters down here aren't talking.
Yeah, it's bad like that. But it's funny. It's got to be a chuckle. I ain't offended by it. I'm laughing at it. Yeah, I just felt like it was borrowing too much from too many other shows. That's why I'd never really bother with it. Just felt boring and borrowing. So there you go. Chilling in my 30s. And that goes to the last one, because I'm not doing My Hero Academia. I just don't really care to talk about it. I don't want to talk about My Hero Academia no more. I'm just tired of it. Tale of Outcasts is our last one. This one was streamed on Crunchyroll for 13 episodes, done by Asahi. Isn't it Asahi? It might be Ashi production. I think it's supposed to be Asahi. But yeah, this one follows Wisteria, who is the orphan of this one orphanage, and she's constantly being taken out to the side of the road to pretty much panhandle to ask people for money. You kind of find out really quickly that this church guy that's running this orphanage is just using her. Eventually kind of find out that she's at the same time being prospected to be sold off to a noble, so they can do whatever they want to her. And whenever she's back in her room, the only thing that's really getting her through this tough time being in this situation is that at some point while she was panhandling, she ended up spotting this demon-looking guy, and she noticed him, and it surprised him because normally people can't see him when he's in that form. And so he kind of comes by whenever she requests him to come by to her room, where they sit down together, and he tells her the stories of his travels, because he's lived for a long time. He's traveled everywhere. And so he'll drop by to actually tell her his stories. And he sort of does it because he kind of likes that, you know, that conversation that he's able to have. He doesn't want to admit it, but that he kind of likes it. At the same time, she loves hearing his stories because she's stuck there and she can't travel the world. So she's able to get all those stories. Well, she gets sold eventually, and she's pleading to him, you know, take me away from here. Don't let them sell me off. And he's like, I can't do that. As a demon, I cannot do a favor to a human without some sort of payment. Otherwise, it will kill me. I will disintegrate. That's the whole idea of the demons themselves. And so she's like, well, I'll give you my soul. And he's like, I don't need it because I already am living for forever. So it's not a payment. That's not a proper payment. So there's nothing that she can give to him that would be a proper payment to save her. So thus he can't do anything. And so she gets sold off. Eventually he doesn't like the idea because he finds out what the guy's going to do to her, which is basically torment her. He gets a kick out of tormenting cute little girls. And so he rushes in the door and goes to save her. And of course, doing that makes him start to decay. He's going to die. So she ends up finding something that would be something that she can sacrifice to him that would allow him not to disintegrate. And that is her vision, which is very powerful because she's able to see demons. So the pact is created. He will protect her for the cost of her vision. And so saves her life. And then they decide to travel together. During their journeys, he will tell her what they're seeing, while at the same time, she's able to give him a camaraderie, basically. So that's the kind of pairing they create between the two of them. And they travel the world, run into a lot of other demons that are also packed with other humans and their stories, and eventually leading up to this big, massive conflict that kind of comes up to later parts with some demons. So my thoughts on the Tale of Outcasts, I like this show more than I thought I would, which is kind of surprising because it's got a really nasty rating on Mal. It's like one of those things when I watch the show, I'm like, man, I was expecting like, you know, hentai levels of garbage writing here, but no, I actually really liked it. I think my main key thing that I like most about this series, I love Wisteria and Marbus, the demon. I think their chemistry is really super good. Because, yeah, you do sort of have a semi-tsundere demon guy that doesn't want to admit that he likes her presence and kind of badmouths her or whatever, and every now and then. At the same time, Wisteria is just kind of very pure nature, is always kind of throws him off now and then. She just kind of likes being with him, enjoys her time with him, likes that, again, she hasn't really had anything before. Now she has somebody that can explain things to her and tell her what they're kind of experiencing, which I really do love the two of them together. I think my only real downfalls, I really loved Diana and Navaris. Their story as well was fantastic. It's basically, it's this noble family that Diana was a part of. And their family was a family that made pacts with demons to be able to see demons and thus be informants to the royal throne when somebody came with the threat of a demon. So if assassin wants to take down the king, he'd walk through the front door with a demon at his side. Nobody would see the demon, and the demon would kill the king. So they employed this noble family who made pacts with demons to be able to say, king, there's a demon with him. Or, you know, get back, there's a threat here. And eventually it comes to this point where they end up becoming betrayed. So, seen as they failed their mission, basically. They failed in protecting a certain target. And thus, that basically made their entire family shamed. And they were sought to be killed because they made pacts with demons. So it's like, you made us pact with demons to protect you. And then when we failed, suddenly, now we're pact with demons and thus must die. It's that hypocrisy and using something that's dark while at the same time being a use for good. And so I like that whole story. I like the relationship with those two characters as well. There was a story with this one girl that was homeless that I thought was absolutely fantastic. The commander and the forces hunting down the demons themselves was okay. There's like two other factions there. But I think the only issue that I really have with the series is it's kind of the same issue that I had with a certain other show, which has a cute girl and then beast guy, Grimoire of Zero. There's a lot of Zero shows. Grimoire of Zero with this, I have the same problem with this as I have with Grimoire of Zero. I loved it better when it was a story about Wisteria and Marbus traveling and experiencing different people. Those stories were fantastic. Same with Grimoire Zero. I love the mage and the big bodyguard just traveling around and experiencing the world. The moment that it got so focused on the factions, the church coming after the demons, the commander with the army, and all that stuff, when it started getting focused in that, and then you have this other big demon, and he's trying to manipulate this whole area and take, and they're you have this war craving demon that's constantly trying to destroy things for the sake of battle. That stuff, when it got into that stuff, it just kind of lost a lot of its flavor that I really enjoyed, which was Marbus and Wisteria just enjoying their time together. A very common casualty in a lot of these stories where it just feels like they have the necessity to get into something big. They always feel like it needs to be a big battle. There has to be a big battle. There has to be a big bad. We have to do this. And it ruins it in the end. So, started good. Enjoy the characters. Just kind of falls off probably after Diana's story. I think that's about the point which kind of just falls off. The moment they get into the commander and all that other stuff after that, just kind of just, it just peters off. But it had a really good start. I really enjoyed the beginning section of it. So, yeah, that's Tale of Outcasts. I don't know if I sold anybody on that or if I just confused people. I'm good at that. It always comes with the ones where it's a mixed bag, so. Yep.
Well, that's all right. I try to explain that I don't really hate something when I sound like I hate it, so.
I hate this show. My Hero Academia 6, I'll just say that it was okay. Compared to the fifth season, it's basically Edge Boy moment for Deku. He turned to Edge Boy. I don't know about that show anymore. It feels like it's building up to something. I don't know. We'll see. I'm just watching it because I've watched too many episodes at this point. So
I think I'm gonna just go and I don't know if I have time.
Burn the manga at some point. Just pop it up on your phone, burn the manga or something.
I don't know. I need to watch the movie and like two seasons now, right?
I never watched the movie and I'm fine. I gave up on that a long time ago. I'm like, okay, you're showing the season over here before the movie. I'll just watch the TV and we'll move on.
Well, I've got Demon Hunter Slayer as well that I gotta watch.
Yeah, you gotta watch Thighs Hunter.
My girl. Gotta get my girl in a box.
Yeah, best girl in the box too, yeah. She's barely showed up. Well, no, she just showed up the first episode, yeah. Anyways, that's the winter 2023 anime season. We finally got them all done. That was a lot, but it's done. So there you go. As per usual, we hope you guys enjoy all these reviews. And you'll stick around, sub to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/otakuspirit, or just keep us on your podcast as we go forward into the spring season. And hopefully Chris and... can enjoy that season. He didn't get to enjoy much of winter, so hopefully
as it stands right now, I'm a little bit I have a few more shows than I did before, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, how ready are you for this first impressions?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I have no clue.
You want another week? Oh, how many shows have you watched in the spring season so far?
I think it would be a better guess to find out how many I haven't watched yet.
No, that's actually much more complicated. That's fine, though. I was curious for the sake of recording our first impressions. It'll probably be next week. You think next week sometime?
Probably.
Yeah. We'll just do that. And we got a music episode. We got to do the music episode, too. So I got to start actually writing down shows. I've been really bad this season because I've been swamped. Keeping up Mushoku Mondays and everything like that. But we're making it. We're almost done with the first impressions, and things start settling down. So for those who don't know, Mushoku Mondays, we are just about to move into Volume 11. So that's been a lot of fun. So
this is where I'm getting excited. I do want to catch up on your Mushoku.
Everybody's big on the 12. Everybody's just waiting for 12. Well, now my expectation's high for 12.
So. I know I looked into your books, and I thought it was 11.
It might be 12. 10 was easily the most lacking. In the tier list, that's going to definitely go in the lower end of it. But I've been trying to keep up a tier list of the volumes, but we're not spoiling anything, by the way. Looking forward to the next season, though, which I guess at this point I would probably be ahead of the anime before it airs. Like, I'll probably... They'll probably do a single core in summer, and I'll probably be fully caught up to that entire adaptation. But I still have to finish what's probably going to be the second core if they do just two core. Anyways, I'm getting off on Mushoku. You get me talking about Mushoku, I stop talking about Mushoku. But anyways, we hope you guys enjoy this reviews of the winter season. And as usual, we appreciate everybody that supports the channel through linking us out, sharing us. All the great comments, and yes, for those that support us on Patreon, our tips links, our super thanks on YouTube and memberships on YouTube. You guys mean a lot to us, and y'all take care.
Oos!